time and about how grateful we are to be in this country, to be able to be free.
The new series of Life Changing, next Wednesday morning at 9. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
And this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Friday the 27th of March. This is Today with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson.
The headlines this morning, President Trump has said he'll delay obliterating Iranian energy plants for another 10 days, claiming that talks are going well. The former head of MI6 will join us at 10 past 8. Parents in England are being told by the government that children under 5 should have less than an hour a day of screen time. We'll be hearing from one family doing their best to cut down on screens.
It's on my mind every day, but at the same time, it's just like you've got other pressures, and most of the time it is to avoid conflicts, meltdowns, and to give yourself a bit of a break.
Also in today's programme, penalty agony for Wales.
Calmly done! Wales' World Cup dream is over. The American dream is dead. It's Bosnia who celebrates.
And Northern Ireland's dream of a first World Cup in 40 years is also over. Mike will bring us reaction to those twin disappointments. And the weather may not feel all that much like spring, but the nature writer Robert McFarlane is here to point us to nature's signs of hope.
Queen bumblebees clamber from their underground chambers, having simply slept the winter away. Lucky them. I find them lying on the sun-warmed tiles of our doorstep, panting like knackered rugby players in their striped jerseys, before lurching drunkenly into flight.
All that after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Alan Smith.
President Trump has said he will push back any bombing of Iran's energy facilities by a further 10 days. He'd threatened the attacks unless the country reopened the Strait of Hormuz to tankers. Mr. Trump said Iran had requested an extension to the deadline and he'd agreed because the talks were going well. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
Iran has denied that it asked for President Trump to delay attacks on the country's energy infrastructure, but he insisted the request was made. In a post on his Truth Social platform, he said the deadline would be extended until April the 6th, while the talks were ongoing. He said he was being generous because Iran had allowed several oil tankers, which he said were Pakistani-flagged, to move through the Strait of Hormuz. He'd earlier described this as a present from Tehran. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has declined to comment on a report in the Wall Street Journal which suggests the US is considering deploying an additional 10,000 ground troops to the Middle East.
Israel says it's carried out another wave of airstrikes in Tehran. Several explosions have also been heard in the south of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, where Israel has been attacking targets, it says, are linked to the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah. New government guidance for parents in England says children under the age of 2 shouldn't have any screen time by themselves. The advice for children between 2 and 5 is that viewing should be limited to a maximum of an hour a day. Here's our senior education reporter, Vanessa Clark.
This is the government's first evidence-backed practical advice for screen use for children under 5. It has previously said that around 98% of children are watching screens on a daily basis by the age of 2. And there's an impact on the language of those who use them the most. The guidance was developed by a panel led by the Children's Commissioner and the children's health expert, Professor Russell Viner. Alongside time limits, it recommends parents don't allow screen use at mealtimes or in the hour before bed. It says fast-paced videos should be avoided, as well as AI toys and tools.
BBC News understands the government will ask Lord Mandelson to hand over messages from his personal phone as part of the disclosure of documents about his appointment as ambassador to the US. The Cabinet Office is preparing to publish thousands more files after MPs backed their release last month. But so far, it has only had access to Lord Mandelson's work phone. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
Government insiders insist they had always planned to ask Lord Mandelson for his personal messages. They say the move is not connected to the theft in October of the mobile owned by the Prime Minister's former Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney. There had been claims this device may have had messages between the two men. Gaining access to Lord Mandelson's personal mobile could help to patch together exchanges that the former US ambassador had with senior Labour figures. Officials are understood to be in possession of some messages between Lord Mandelson and Mr. McSweeney, but the government has refused to confirm whether others may have been lost. Yesterday, Sir Keir said conspiracy theories about the theft were a little far-fetched, but writing in The Telegraph, the Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch claimed there was something fishy going on and called for files around the theft to also be disclosed.
Supporters and opponents of assisted dying plans in England and Wales have both acknowledged the measure is unlikely to pass before the current parliamentary session ends in May. The House of Lords is debating the legislation for the 13th time today, with some peers accused of deliberately prolonging the discussion so that the bill runs out of time. Our political correspondent Ian Watson reports.
Although there are two more days of debate scheduled in the Lords, peers opposed to the assisted dying bill have said it's clear the legislation will fall. It was passed by MPs last June, but its sponsor in the upper house, Lord Faulkner, accused opponents of dragging out the process. And earlier this month, supporters of the bill had acknowledged that it was, in effect, impossible for it to pass before the end of the parliamentary session in May. Some called for it to be brought back in the next session. In a letter to MPs, opponents said this was concerning, as serious issues had not yet been examined.
The government is being called on to make a formal apology to many thousands of women in England who were forced in the past to give up their babies because they weren't married. The Commons Education Committee described the practice of historical forced adoptions in the years after the Second World War as inhumane. It says the government in Westminster should follow the example of the Scottish and Welsh administrations by apologising. Football, and Wales and Northern Ireland have both missed out on a place at this summer's World Cup. Northern Ireland lost 2-0 to Italy in their semi-final playoff. The game between Wales and Bosnia went to penalties when the match finished 1-1 after extra time. Bosnia held their nerve with Kerim Alibegovic breaking Welsh hearts to take his team to a 4-2 victory on penalties.
Carl Darlow, your country needs you now. Save the first one in the shootout. Has to do it this time. Alibegovic scores. Penalty pain for Wales again. They led in normal time. Dzeko equalised just before the end of the 90 minutes. And Wales will not be at the World Cup this summer.
The British artist Olivia Dean was the big winner at last night's MOBO Awards in Manchester, which recognises black music and culture. She took home three prizes, including Best Female Act, Best Song and Album of the Year. She dedicated the final award to black feminists, who she said had inspired her to love better.
This album was really just born out of me wanting to write something about love. So, thank you so much. I love everyone. See you. Bye.
That was Olivia Dean at the MOBO Awards.
7 minutes past six is the time. Let us turn with some trepidation to Chris Fawkes at the BBC Weather Centre, because it has been chilly, hasn't it?
It has been, Justin. Yeah, we've got some further changes, actually, in our weather picture today. A band of rain is pushing its way southwards and eastwards across England and Wales, bringing some wet weather here. Brighter skies pushing into Scotland and Northern Ireland, but with some blustery showers on the way later on. Now, talking about the rain, across England and Wales, it's a cloudy start to the day for the vast majority, with wet weather for Northern England, Wales, the southwest of England, the rain getting into the Midlands too. A few heavy bursts mixed in across parts of Cumbria, Lancashire, northern and central areas of Wales. But as this weather front continues its journey southeastwards, bringing the rain into East Anglia and southeast England as we head into the afternoon, well, the rain will turn lighter and patchier in nature. Further north, across Scotland and Northern Ireland, quite quickly this morning, the sunshine should come out. Those brighter skies will gradually edge southwards, reaching Northern England and Wales as we go on through the afternoon, perhaps the North Midlands as well. It's not going to be entirely dry, though, across northern portions of the UK, because we are going to see lots of showers pushing into Scotland and Northern Ireland, with a few getting into the northwest of both England and Wales late in the day. The showers coming through frequently across the northwest, with the risk of some hail and thunder mixed in with the showers. You might find a little bit of sleet at times in Scotland as well. The winds will continue to pick up in Scotland, actually, through the day as well. Gusts reaching around 40 or 50 miles an hour, so turning quite blustery here. Temperatures nationwide, generally quite close to average, 10 to 13 Celsius, but in the Scottish Highlands and Islands, just 7 Celsius today. Looking at the forecast for tomorrow, we've got some strong winds affecting the north of the UK. It's a day of sunshine and showers. The showers will increasingly have hail and sleet mixed in with them, particularly across Scotland and, to a degree, Northern Ireland, northwest England as well. That's the latest.
Thank you, Chris. Yes, just a reminder, it is spring. We'll be looking for the good side of spring with Robert McFarlane in the next hour of the programme. Let's take a look now at 6:09 at the morning papers. The Times says Donald Trump has paused airstrikes on Iran's energy infrastructure because Tehran asked, quotes, very nicely, for more time. The Guardian quotes the US president as saying that despite erroneous statements to the contrary, talks with the Islamic Republic are going very well. The Sun is amongst the papers to point out that Mr. Trump mocked the UK's aircraft carriers as toys, adding he didn't need them. The Metro says President Trump has thrown our toys out of the pram.
According to the Daily Mail, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is raking in soaring tax receipts from higher prices at the pumps. It says she's displaying typical sanctimony by accusing fuel giants of cashing in, while she is the real petrol profiteer. The Daily Express describes Ms. Reeves as an agent of destruction, saying her tax raids, growth-killing policies are pushing the UK to the bottom rungs of the G7 growth table. The I paper says the government's reacted to the worsening forecast by arguing that its decisions have put the UK in a better position to protect family finances from global instability.
For a third day, the Telegraph leads with the failings at the NS&I Bank. It says the Treasury knew about the savings scandal last year and had already cut the bonus at the bank's boss, Dax Harkins, who's now been fired. The paper says critics have demanded answers over the time taken to tackle the problems. The Treasury Minister, Torsten Bell, accused the last government of not acting. The paper's cartoonist, Matt, illustrates the story with one man telling another in the pub, if I won £1 million from premium bonds, it wouldn't change me. Probably because I'd never find out.
The Times says nearly 500 staff at the Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, are going on strike today and tomorrow in protest at a below-inflation pay offer of 2.75%. The paper notes this comes at a time when the BMA is demanding a 26% rise for its own members. The GMB union, which represents BMA staff, is quoted as saying the strikes have laid bare the union's ongoing hypocrisy.
The Sun and The Mirror both lead with the new guidance for parents about screen use for children. We're going to be talking to a child psychologist and the minister responsible about that later in the programme. The Sun notes that the advice extends to warning parents to watch their own phone use because children could copy their habits. The Mirror agrees that talking, playing and simply being present still matters far more than any app or video.
6:12. President Trump has extended his deadline for Iran to talk before he says he will launch attacks on its energy plants. This is what he told Fox News.
And so I gave them a 10-day period. They asked for 7. You're going to say, oh, Trump's a terrible negotiator. They asked for 7. And I said, I'm going to give you 10.
Well, what is his agenda then? Is he simply playing for time? Is this a real effort to get meaningful talks going? Our correspondent in the US is Peter Bowes.
This is very much Donald Trump's agenda. He had previously announced a 48-hour pause, then a 5-day pause on strikes against Iran's energy infrastructure. The 5 days due to end today. Earlier in the week, he has said, and this reflects really what you're saying, that, again, this is his agenda, very good and productive conversations, he said, that were aimed at complete and total resolution of hostilities, although Iran has denied that talks to end the war are taking place. But just to share exactly what he has posted in the last few hours on Truth Social, he writes, as per Iranian government request, please let this statement serve to represent that I am pausing the period of energy plant destruction by 10 days. Now that takes us up to April the 6th, and the president goes on to say again that talks are ongoing and going very well. So this is very much a one-sided assessment of the situation because Iran has denied making such a request, indeed has never confirmed that these talks are underway, as the president is insisting.
Meanwhile, also in the last few hours, the Wall Street Journal reporting the potential for a large number of extra troops to be sent to the area.
Yes, ground troops. Now, of course, this has never been off the table ever since the war started at the end of last month, but there have been several reports in the last few days that additional troops are being prepared to be sent to the region. Just a couple of days ago, we heard about thousands of paratroopers, specialists in airborne assault operations, and now, as you say, the Wall Street Journal reporting that the Pentagon is looking at sending up to 10,000 additional ground troops. Now, we asked the Pentagon about this. They declined to comment. But if true, it would mark a significant escalation on the US side. It would certainly raise the stakes as far as President Trump is concerned, and perhaps an escalation that would likely not be welcomed by a significant number of people in this country who are already nervous about how and when this war is going to end.
Peter Bowes, thank you.
It's coming up to 6:15 now. Meantime, listen to this. The president is not just doing a favour to the United States and our people. This is for the world. Those are the words of the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, uttered before he set off for Paris for a meeting of G7 foreign ministers. Travelling with him is our correspondent, Nomia Iqbal. Morning to you, Nomia. And what is striking is this is Rubio's first visit outside the United States since this war began.
It is. And he actually skipped the first day of the G7. It was yesterday. And I mean, he has this unenviable task in many respects to try and sell the strategy of the Iran war. He's here to talk to the other G7 members. Lots of stuff on the agenda. Of course, Ukraine will be on it too. But it's ultimately about Iran, trying to reopen the Strait of Hormuz and explaining the position on Iran, which, quite frankly, is not easy to do, given that President Trump himself has given incredibly mixed messages. As Peter Bowes was saying there earlier, there's a real one-sided assessment of what is happening at the moment. So he will hold these meetings later today. He was asked, you quoted there from the press pool that spoke to him, but he was asked about the negotiations, but he wouldn't speculate on them. He just said it's an ongoing process. And basically, he's framing this as to Europe, look, you've got to help us. You know, we didn't start the war in Ukraine. That's not our war, but we're helping you, so you've got to help us. Exactly what that help looks like is the controversy, because G7 nations broadly, they are united against Iran's retaliatory attacks, but they're completely divided, or maybe they're actually a little bit more aligned than we realize on whether US and Israel were right to start the war. It could be economic pressure may force their hands, but that's the tension that Marco Rubio will be dealing with today.
Their message to him is make this stop, is it?
Essentially, and to help us. So there are a few things that the G7 members are doing, you know, in terms of helping. So there's talks of escort missions. So France, for example, announced potential escort missions for merchant ships transiting the strait. But generally speaking, they don't want anything to do with it. Germany has said it's not our war. UK is also, you know, there's this potential of escort missions, but they don't want to do what Donald Trump wants, which is to send warships to the region. Italy and Japan also don't want anything to do with the war, which is quite interesting, Nick, given that Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni is very close to President Trump, the only European leader that went to his inauguration. And then you have Canada, who has called for de-escalation. So we'll see exactly what comes of it. It's worth remembering that, you know, the statement that they release, it's not binding in any way, but it is politically very powerful. Mm. But as I say, with oil prices globally spiking, economic pressure may force their hands. So it might be that they don't agree with the war if they get involved. They just can't afford the economic fallout.
Nomia Iqbal in Paris. Thank you.
It is 17 minutes past six before President Trump extended that deadline, as he put it, pausing the period of energy plant destruction until April the 6th. Stock markets in the US had just wrapped up their worst trading day since the conflict began. Will is here with more on that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Will.
Morning, Justin. Morning, Nick. Yes, interesting hearing both Peter Bowes and Nomia talk about those mixed messages. Certainly what financial markets seemed to take yesterday. European markets closing down first. The S&P 500, the US's main index, really sharply, 1.75%, its worst one-day performance of the war so far. And it led to then, at 8:11 p.m. on the East Coast, President Trump making that Truth Social post 11 minutes after-hours trading finished on Wall Street. Randeep Sommel is with us, fund manager at M&G Investment Management. Randeep, morning.
Good morning.
The timing seems more than coincidental about that after what ended up being a pretty chaotic day, not just for stocks, but for trading full stop yesterday.
It did. I mean, the Nasdaq fared even worse than the S&P. I mean, what we've seen of President Trump is he's not as reactive to what the markets do in his second term as quite as he was his first. But with midterms approaching, with inflation rising, commodity price rising, markets falling, I think he has started to realise that this will have a huge implication for Republicans come November.
Yeah, well, do the sweep for us as well. That was share markets, equity markets. What about oil also rising yesterday, and what went on in government bonds?
It is. I mean, we've seen pressure across the board now. Oil, European Brent is back above 100. I mean, the thing to point with oil is that the futures market, so if you look out past into the summer, it's still down to about $80. So the market is still anticipating that we see a resolution in the Middle East in the Strait of Hormuz opening. But near term, those prices continue to creep up. And unfortunately for Europe, as do natural gas prices.
Yeah. So what about closer to home? Take us through what went on, particularly on the FTSE 100 yesterday then.
Yeah, I mean, it was tough across the board. FTSE 100 was down nearly 1.5% as well. Again, the issue with this prolonged war in the Middle East having an impact both on UK consumers, but also the likelihood of interest rate rises in the UK.
Yeah, and we've seen, I'm looking at the kind of futures markets for both the FTSE and the S&P 500. I mean, they look like they're kind of creeping up at the moment, but not really regaining those losses. Is that too... the mixed messages that we were hearing from our correspondents about there, the sort of the unknowns, really, even if this is a pause?
Yeah, I mean, it's a reaction to what we've seen, a deep downdraft in the US market. Some of the Asian markets are a little bit more positive this morning. But yes, Europe, obviously much closer to home with what's going on in the Middle East, are still seeing it as a negative reaction.
Randeep, stay with us. We'll pick through some companies news as well in just a moment with you. But we've got Rona O'Connell alongside Randeep as well this morning. Rona is the head of market analysis at StoneX Financial. And Rona, you in particular have been looking at the price of gold because that's been falling quite sharply too in the weeks since the war began, even if it's rallying a little bit this morning.
Good morning, Will. Yes. People will quite often ask why gold comes down when markets are under stress, because it's supposed to be a safe haven. And this is where we have to differentiate between price and value. It acts as an insurance policy, and almost invariably when equities or occasionally treasuries are under stress, then gold gets sold by investors who are hurting because they need, or they perceive the need perhaps, to raise cash and liquidity against potential margin calls. So almost invariably it does come down, and then when the dust settles, those distressed sellers will reinvest and take out that insurance policy again. And it looks as if that's very much what's happened this time around. And it's interesting in the very short term to notice that even with what happened to equities yesterday, gold has actually held steady, which suggests that profit takers and weak-handed holders are now out of the market. And it's looking at the geopolitical problems at the very least as an underpinning factor. So for the time being, professional trading houses are not really doing anything at all. They're sitting on their hands because they just want to stand on the sidelines and wait and see what's going to happen. But it's done its job and it's now stabilising.
Right, so not even moving into those safe havens as a result. So what is that telling you about perhaps the next few weeks then, and what from a market perspective people are reading from the politics?
I would expect a sideways channel, but probably quite choppy. As I said, the professional houses are not doing very much. The market itself hasn't thinned particularly. There's still a decent two-way order flow. But everybody's watching what's going on in the Gulf in particular. And then behind that, of course, we've got the tensions in the United States over Fed governance and potential politicization. And the next specific pivot that I would look at will be the ruling from the Supreme Court on the Lisa Cook case, because if they find in favour of the administration's appeal, that blurs the distinction between the legislative, the executive and the judiciary, which is the cornerstone or a cornerstone of the United States Constitution. And a decision in favour of the politicians could play merry hell with the Treasury market, to be perfectly honest. That's a very important one.
Lisa Cook, to remind people, is one of those members of the Federal Reserve, the Central Bank's Board of Governance as well. Just context is important with all of this as well, Rona. Contextualise it compared to other shocks we've had, perhaps the Ukraine-Russian war, because we're looking at these kind of one-day and week-long and two-week-long and month-long moves that are pretty wild across all the markets. Put it in context for other shocks. Is this one, as, for example, Fatih Birol, the head of the International Energy Agency, suggested, bigger than those?
It is, because there's a degree of uncertainty about it, because the Russia and the Ukraine is a binary issue, if you like. This one, it has got several different elements in the equation. So to that extent, there is a higher degree of uncertainty. As far as the gold price was concerned, in the wake of the, or as the Russia-Ukraine situation developed, it did come down in line with just about everything else, and it actually took a little bit of time to recover, which is what we're seeing here. In the COVID crisis, amongst all the precious and base metals and the major European and US stock markets, it fell, but by nowhere near as much as anything else, and it was the first one to recover, and it unwound its losses in the space of 6 weeks, whereas the S&P took over a year.
Rona, thanks so much for your time this morning. Rona O'Connell there, Head of Market Analysis at StoneX. Randy, quick thought on some companies' news from yesterday, because in terms of individual shares, Currys was a significant faller in the UK as the boss, Alex Baldock, who we've had on the programme many times, surprisingly announced he was leaving after 8 years.
He was, and Alex has done a successful turnaround at Currys, the UK high street, which has found itself in a very tough situation over the past few years with challenges from online. Currys was quite a bright spot, so a negative reaction there to know that the CEO is stepping down.
Radneep Samal of M&G Investments, thanks so much for your time. Now, with Paramount's mega deal to buy rival film and TV studio Warner Brothers Discovery still rumbling on in the background, the Hollywood actor turned producer Eva Longoria has told us that major consolidation in the media industry could lead to innovation and diversity dying, as it encourages what she called a cookie cutter approach to production. We spoke to her, who she now runs a production company called Hyphenate Media Group, as she promotes Lenovo's Backing Every Business initiative, which pairs small businesses together to inspire collaboration. We started by chatting about, though, the mood in Hollywood surrounding those mergers.
There's, a couple of different vibes happening. One is really AI technology changing our industry or how it's done. Not knowing enough about it, knowing too much about it. Like, there's just a lot of concern about, is it a tool or is it a competitor? So that conversation is happening. At the same time, there's intense consolidation. And when there's an intense consolidation of buyers, that's never good for any industry, right? I mean, we can see it in automotive industry. We can see it in...
So it's that side of it, is it? That there would just be fewer players full stop with Warner gone, rather than who's doing the buying.
Fewer players means less, not only fewer people who are buying, but less diversity of thought and less diversity of thought leaders. You know, I think what YouTube and streamers did was disrupt the idea of who is the gatekeeper to becoming a creator, right? You had to go through the studio system, you had to go through these proper channels, and now you can have a show and you can shoot something on your iPhone and you can put it up. And oh my gosh, you're a great storyteller. Like, you don't have to go through these traditional legacy studios. You can do it on your own.
From a pure business perspective, what does that mean to you running a production company? And what would it mean, say, if Paramount does take over Warner Brothers?
Again, it's the consolidation is the scary part of it, especially when you see a consolidation and you see a massive amount of job loss of creatives, because now it's just it comes into this siloed system of intake. And so when I probably will just pitch one person for five different buyers. But that one person, you know, pitching to one person, what happens in that process is innovation dies, diversity dies. It becomes very cookie cutter of like, we're looking for a medical procedure. And then it just becomes about that.
So regulators need to look at this closely then.
Yeah. I mean, I think we all need to pay attention to what's going to happen. Supposedly it's going to operate separately still, but you know, who knows?
Very last one then. World Cup. You must be excited then, as someone, as you say, who's in the football business. Are you ready for it? Are you ready for all of us coming over from Britain?
We're ready to call it football. We are ready.
That's a good start.
I mean, that's a start. I mean, yeah, it's a start. Look, I live between Mexico and Spain and Los Angeles. And so I was just in Mexico, and oh my God, the airport's a mess because of just the amount of people that they're expecting and trying to really build out the airport so that it is a more streamlined process. But look, any country that hosts the World Cup ends up better off because the infrastructure is being built to for easier flow. And so hopefully next year we'll all benefit from that. But we're excited. We're actually excited. I've always been excited about the World Cup, no matter where it is in the world. I just find it fascinating that the global language of the world is football, is soccer. You can be from anywhere in the world and understand and speak the language of football. And that to me is so uniting. And I think sports is one of the few things that we can look forward to in this moment. In this moment of history that could unite us.
Hollywood actor turned producer and, as you heard, football club owner Eva Longoria there.
Desperate Housewives meets the Today programme. Remember where you were when you heard that. Thank you, Will.
It's the meeting we needed, isn't it, for a move into YouTube.
It is. She sounded awfully cheery about the World Cup, but Mike, there are a lot of people this morning are not feeling at all cheerful.
Oh, Desperate Housewives, desperate times for Wales and Northern Ireland because, yes, Nick, as you allude to, the World Cup dream died for both of those nations last night. Let's start in Cardiff, where Wales missed out on the World Cup this summer in the cruelest of fashions.
It is penalty pain yet again for Wales. The red shirts in the centre circle fall to the turf, crestfallen. The Bosnian players sprint over to their travelling fans. Wales are beaten from 12 yards. They fall agonisingly short again. This will sting, and rightly so.
Yes, Wales missed out on a second successive major tournament on penalties last night. They lost their World Cup semi-final playoff at home to Bosnia and Herzegovina. Here is the story of the match from Alistair Bruce Ball.
Penalty pain for Wales again. 2 years to the day that Poland denied them a place at Euro 2024 in a shootout in Cardiff. This time it was Bosnia and Herzegovina blocking their path to a major tournament. That after Carl Darlow saved the first penalty. But once Brennan Johnson hit his over the bar and Nico Williams saw his comfortably palmed away, it was left to 18-year-old Kerim Alibegovic to apply the cruel coup de grace. Wales were just 4 minutes away too from winning the game in the 90 minutes. Dan James fizzing long-range half volley looked like it was going to win it before Edin Dzeko headed a late equaliser. A 40-year-old with that goal, an 18-year-old with the winning penalty. They now host Italy for a place in the World Cup this summer, and Wales will have to use the pain of defeat to make them stronger.
Let's head inside the Welsh camp then and hear from a very crestfallen Wales manager Craig Bellamy and their captain Ethan Ampadu.
Very disappointed. You know, it's not the hard luck Wales run. We expect to be at major tournaments, or we really push ourselves to be there. There was a lot good tonight that really gives a good opportunity of being here, but it wasn't to be.
We're lost for words. We prepared as well as we could have for this game. I thought we played really well. I mean, end of the day doesn't really matter because we're not going there in the summer, which is the disappointing thing. Just sometimes in life it doesn't really go your way.
And we'll have further Welsh reaction to that defeat later in the programme. Meanwhile, as we say, Northern Ireland's dreams of reaching a first World Cup in 40 years are also over. They held their own away to Italy in Bergamo for almost an hour last night before eventually succumbing to a 2-0 defeat. Here's the Northern Ireland manager, Michael O'Neill.
Look, it was a very young team tonight. I think the average age of the team is maybe just 22 years of age. They gave everything. And that's all we can ask. I'm very proud of them. And I think, you know, we showed that we've made, huge strides as a team as well.
And just to complete a hat-trick of disappointing results last night, the Republic of Ireland, excuse me, were also knocked out of the World Cup on penalties by the Czech Republic. Excuse me, it's all getting a bit too... it's getting a bit too much for me. Yeah, exactly. One chink of good news, perhaps, from a British perspective is that an English manager is at least one step closer to reaching the World Cup. Graham Potter's Sweden now one win away from qualifying after beating Ukraine 3-1. Last night in their semi-final.
Mike, thank you. Next week, Radio 4 dissects the techniques criminals use to steal your money.
Scam Secrets is back for a new series.
The manipulation starts very subliminally.
I'm Shari Vahl. I investigate fraud for the BBC. Each week, I dissect the techniques criminals use to steal your money.
Hey, Shruti, I missed you a lot.
We associate so much fraud with the male voice, but the female voice we trust for various psychological reasons.
Please call me.
From romance and investment scams to one targeting online holiday bookings.
It was actually over 1,800 euros.
exposing the fraudster's tactics to help keep you safe. Scam Secrets starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds next Thursday lunchtime at 12.
It is now 27 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson, and Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
President Trump has said he will push back any bombing of Iran's energy facilities by a further 10 days. He threatened the attacks unless the country reopened the Strait of Hormuz to tankers. In a post on social media, Mr. Trump said Iran had requested an extension and he'd agreed because the talks were going well. Iran's denied asking for a delay. Israel says it's carried out another wave of airstrikes in Tehran. Several explosions have also been heard in the south of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, where Israel has been attacking targets which it says are linked to the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah. New government guidance for parents in England says children under the age of 2 shouldn't have any screen time by themselves. The advice for children between 2 and 5 is that viewing should be limited to a maximum of an hour a day. BBC News understands the government will ask Lord Mandelson to hand over messages from his personal phone as part of the disclosure of documents about his appointment as ambassador to the US. The Cabinet Office is preparing to publish thousands more files, but so far it's only had access to Lord Mandelson's work phone. Supporters and opponents of assisted dying plans in England and Wales have both acknowledged the measure is unlikely to pass before the current parliamentary session ends in May. The House of Lords is debating the legislation for the 13th time today, with some peers accused of deliberately prolonging the discussion so the bill runs out of time. And the government is being called on to make a formal apology to many thousands of women in England who were forced in the past to give up their babies because they weren't married. The Commons Education Committee described the practice of historical forced adoptions in the years after the Second World War as inhumane.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. It's now 25 to 7. We speak of the fog of war. This morning, what are we to make of the news that Donald Trump has postponed plans for what he calls the obliteration of Iran by 10 days, while at the same time, there are reports that 10,000 more US troops are on their way to the region. Our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell, joins us from Jerusalem. What are they making of it there, Yolande?
This is a top story across much of the Israeli media, but not much is officially being said, Nick. There's obviously been no pause in the war overall. Israel's military said that overnight it completed what it called a wide-scale wave of strikes targeting Iranian regime infrastructure in the heart of Tehran. It's saying it's going after ballistic missiles and air defense systems, other targets in the West. And this after there were multiple Iranian rocket attacks on Israel yesterday. There've been more drone strikes in the Gulf. The Revolutionary Guard saying it's also targeting military sites used by US forces. The Israeli journalist Barak Ravid has reaffirmed that report that was in the Wall Street Journal that the Trump administration is considering sending 10,000 more troops to the region and is interpreting that as a signal, of course, that for a possible ground operation by the US military in Iran. It's thought the Pentagon is drawing up plans for that. And there's an American security source being quoted in this report, quoted saying they expect a decision will be made next week.
Meantime, away from Iran, the war continues. For some, it's a second front. For others, it's almost a second war in Lebanon.
That's right. There's been an Israeli airstrike targeting the southern outskirts of Beirut this morning. That's an area known as a stronghold of Hezbollah. Several explosions reported there. Hezbollah yesterday were announcing a large number, 94 operations targeting Israel and Israeli troops in Lebanon. That's the highest number on a single day in the war so far. Its attacks really seem to be escalating at the same time as Israel, of course, has said it's planning to expand its occupation of southern Lebanon. And interestingly, related to all of that, the Israeli military has been coming out saying it needs more troops for deployment in southern Lebanon, where it's they're trying to establish what they're calling a buffer zone. And that has, you know, brought some comments from Israel's political opposition. So far, it's been largely aligned with the government when it comes to the war effort against Iran, but also against Hezbollah and Lebanon. But then in a televised address, Israel's opposition leader Yair Lapid accused the government of steering the country towards what he called a security disaster by sending the army into a multi-front war without a strategy, without the necessary means, and with far too few soldiers.
Yolande Nell in Jerusalem, thank you.
22 minutes to 7. The government is going to ask Peter Mandelson, it seems, for messages stored on his personal phone. You'll remember that Morgan McSweeney, the former chief of staff to the PM, says his phone was stolen shortly after Lord Mandelson was fired as ambassador to the US. Let's talk to Damian Grammaticus, our political correspondent. And the link being, or the potential link being, that this might be a way of getting hold of some of the contacts that those two men had with each other, because they'll still be on Lord Mandelson's personal phone. Is that it?
Justin, my understanding is no, that is not it. That my understanding is from government sources that this is a request that's being made of everyone who is in scope of what MPs asked, which was that the government release all messages dating back and communications dating back to the election and then up to Lord Mandelson's time, and including Lord Mandelson's time as ambassador, all messages that were relevant and related to that. And it will be asked of everyone that their personal messages on their personal phones should be handed over to. Now, of course, there's been one release of a first tranche of information, which was recently. That was government information related to Lord Mandelson's appointment. And officials are now collating the second release, which is expected to be much bigger, will include personal messages, emails, communications. And it's understood that this has always been the plan to ask for these additional messages.
But why the delay? Do we know?
No, we don't. I think it's simply the most likely thing, it seems, is that it's simply the sort of volume of information. That's what the government has said before, that they have to collate here is large, and they need to both gather the information and then sift through it and do a kind of a process where they have to also look at it from the point of view of the police, who, of course, have asked that some information relating to the appointment and vetting is not publicly released because of their ongoing investigation into allegations of misconduct in a public office and against Lord Mandelson. Of course, we have to say Lord Mandelson has not commented publicly, but it's understood that he says, and his belief is, he's not acted in any way criminally, not motivated by financial gain, and he answered all questions about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein.
And presumably he doesn't have to hand over his phone now, nor does anyone. I mean, what people will find really frustrating about this is what is actually going to happen? Do we know for a fact that everyone's messages now, potentially with Morgan McSweeney and about Peter Mandelson, will go into Downing Street, or won't they? We don't really know, do we?
Well, it's not entirely clear. And I mean, I've asked this question myself. And what I understand is that what the Cabinet Office, who are conducting this process, are doing is asking people to hand over the relevant information they hold that's in scope of the motion from MPs.
And if they don't?
Well, that is not clear, but I think what we understand is they are already they're already in possession of some of the messages, because all government communications and government devices, I think they are able to look at. The others, they are being requested.
Damian McGrath, thank you.
It is now, or coming up to 18 minutes to 7. Parents in England are to be given new guidance on how long their children should be allowed to watch a screen. Vanessa Clark is our senior education reporter. Morning to you, Vanessa. I know you've been talking to families about this, but let's begin with what the advice itself is.
Yes, so babies and toddlers under 2 should not have any screen time unless it's shared viewing. And what they're talking about there is, you know, maybe showing them digital photos or calling relatives. And then from 2 to 5 years old, it's a bit more lenient. It should be limited to 1 hour a day with no screen time recommended at meal times and the hour before bed. And interestingly, it also advises parents to steer clear of fast paced content. So, you know, short videos with lots of characters and colours and loud music, and that AI toys and tools should be completely avoided. But I think it's important to say these new limits shouldn't apply in the same way for children with SEND who use assistive technologies. Mm. But the government says all of this will be kept under review, and they've told me they're taking a precautionary approach. So, you know, research shows that long periods of time spent on screens alone can affect sleep and children's development. But there are lots of gaps in the research, particularly, you know, that advice for under 2s is quite strict. So they've decided these are very important years, so they're going maybe on the stricter side of things.
They talk about limits, The truth is, it's just advice. It's words, isn't it, from Minister? I mean, given that you've been spending some time with families who struggle to control the screen time of their children, how do ministers think that this will convert into changes in the way parents actually behave?
Well, I think parents are rightly so calling out for advice, and they wanted something quite black and white. And research showed that 98% of under twos are watching and using screens. So I think something was needed. But you're right, this is very much advice. You know, it says parents should trust their own instincts and make their decisions. And then, you know, from the tech point of view, one very tech-friendly parent group I spoke to said on the artificial intelligence point, that's everywhere now. So if you have a smart speaker in your house, your child is going to be interacting with it. Like my kids every day say, what's the weather like today? But I think the experts, it sounds like they've decided to advise parents to avoid all AI because there's so little known about. So I think there was a bit of a balance for ministers about how strong to go, but they wanted to err on the side of caution. But you're very right. This is advice. And really, as some of the advice says, you know, parents should trust their own instincts.
Vanessa Clark, our education reporter, thank you very much indeed. We'll hear from one of the child psychologists who's influenced this research and from the minister later in the programme.
And indeed, we'll hear proper weather forecasts before each hour. Yeah. And not so good ones at the half hour as well, read by us. Time now, 16 minutes to 7. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has called on the Doctors' Union to call off its strikes, those strikes planned for next month, and to return to the negotiating table, as he put it. Let us hear from our parliamentary correspondent, Sean Curran.
As MPs prepared to leave Westminster for Parliament's Easter break, the international policy group, the OECD, predicted that the conflict in the Middle East would harm the UK's economy more than that of other industrialised nations. A few hours later, the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, warned resident doctors in England that the prospect of a long war meant the government couldn't improve its pay offer.
We are planning on the basis of a prolonged conflict because that is the prudent thing to do. In that eventuality, there would be an impact on the economy and on the public finances. Were that to happen, a future offer to resident doctors will not look better than what is on offer today.
He urged the BMA to rethink its strike action and gave the doctors' union until next Thursday, when he would take the deal off the table. Resident doctors, who used to be known as junior doctors, are set to go on strike for 6 days next month, following the breakdown of talks over jobs and pay. The Conservative Shadow Health Secretary, Stuart Andrew, said when he was in opposition, Wes Streeting had made resolving the strikes sound straightforward.
Just get round the table, just negotiate, just sort it out. He repeatedly stated that the power to stop the strikes lay in the government's hands. Well, the power is now in his hands. He has had every opportunity to prove it, and yet here we are again. Not so easy after all, is it?
The BMA has said the government hasn't done enough to address resident doctors' concerns about pay and a lack of jobs. Wes Streeting said the doctors should think about what sort of government they might have to deal with in the future.
Catch them on a good day. Reform might even say the quiet bit out loud. They don't believe in the NHS. Yeah. They don't believe in it as a public service free at the point of use. And they are certainly not going to treat the BMA or resident doctors with more respect or generosity than a Labour government. And I think the BMA need to reflect on that.
No Reform UK MPs took part in the exchanges. For the Liberal Democrats, Helen Morgan began by criticising the Conservatives and said the last government had damaged the NHS.
Doctors are burnt out from working in high-pressure environments under poor conditions, often trying to save lives on corridors with no space or privacy. But we all know how difficult public finances are. This is being compounded now by Donald Trump's reckless war in the Middle East. A further 26% pay rise, therefore, isn't affordable or realistic at the moment, and it's time the BMA recognised that.
Labour's Lawrence Turner said the BMA's own staff were about to go on strike.
Their employer's offer is 2.75% lower than the 3.5% that the BMA called a crushing blow. Does the Health Secretary agree with the GMB union when they say these strikes have laid bare the BMA's ongoing hypocrisy?
Wes Streeting called it breathtaking hypocrisy.
I'm stunned, actually, by the unwillingness to practice what they preach I will not be joining resident doctors on the picket line, but I should have declared, Madam Deputy Speaker, I am a GMB member. If there's one picket line I'll be visiting during the doctor strikes, it may well be that one.
The Lib Dem chair of the Health Committee, Leila Moran, was another critic of the doctor's strike.
This is clearly the wrong move again. And it is really stark how we keep hearing from patients across the country how much they want the NHS to improve. And this is another blow to those who are wondering if it's safe even to go into their local hospitals during the strike period.
A Conservative, Sir Julian Lewis, wanted to know why the BMA committee had rejected the government's deal.
What's behind this? Why are they behaving in what appears to be an unreasonable and extreme way? And to what extent does he think, at any rate, they represent the junior doctors or the resident doctors themselves?
Well, Madam Deputy Speaker, if the committee had ever taken me up on my offer to meet the entire committee, I might be able to answer the question. But since they've never taken me up on that offer, I don't know.
And the Health Secretary stressed that the current deal was the government's best and final offer.
That was Sean Curran reporting on yesterday in Parliament, and it is now 11 minutes to 7. Who will turn out to be the real global winner once the war is over? Could it be China? If Beijing is able to present itself to the world as a force for stability and a more reliable partner than the United States. To help us reflect on that, we're going to talk at 10 past 8 to a former head of the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. But to start us off on that conversation, we're joined by the Senior Research Fellow on China at Chatham House, Dr. Ye Xie joins us. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick.
Is that how you think, Dr. Ye, that we will see China present itself as a kind of force for stability?
Well, that certainly it is a narrative in Beijing, as I was there last week, and has been presented quite strongly among the scholars and also senior diplomats. I think, however, China is also equally worried about this ripple effects of the war in the Gulf. For example, in terms of energy supply, but also in terms of higher oil price, which also push up the cost of the export as well. So I think Beijing is equally as worried as the rest of the world, and what are the ripple effects of this war bring to them?
Is there a longer-term opportunity for them, though, to say to, for example, the Gulf countries, look, a fat lot of good your relationship with the United States did you. Perhaps you should get closer to us.
Well, I'm in two minds on this. Firstly, I think so far China's responses in terms of mediating the crisis, in terms of get involved, remain very timid. And I think secondly in here, China is also equally worried about the vacuum left by United States within its immediate neighborhood in the Asia-Pacific region that would actually entice China's neighbors, for example, Japan and South Korea, to rearm themselves in order to boosting their own security, and which China will have to manage in its immediate neighborhood. So it's both ways in here.
That's interesting, because some pessimists have assumed that with the attention of the United States diverted to the Middle East, and not just the attention, but all the weaponry and manpower diverted to the Middle East, this was a great opportunity for President Xi of China to say, maybe this is the moment to think of taking Taiwan.
Well, obviously, I think President Xi considers Donald Trump is probably the biggest dove within the current U.S. administration, and hope that Trump will be able to weak its support towards Taiwan, and instead of strengthening the support like the previous administration has done. But I think so far, what Xi Jinping is trying to do is to maintain some kind of reasonable and amenable relationship with Donald Trump, and in order just to keep the stabilization of this very consequential bilateral ties between Beijing and Washington.
Because when you were in China, I imagine much of the talk was about that latest five-year plan, the sort of downgrading of growth as an ambition, and Xi's emphasis on stability.
Surely, I think President Xi feel quite vindicated in terms of the so-called economic plan he had, and obviously give much greater priority towards economic security, energy security, and food security. And look what happened in the Middle East and the economic impacts around the world. And certainly Xi Jinping felt he has done the right thing over the short to medium term. But I think over the longer term trajectory, China as a country, as the world's second largest economy, is success or failure still resting upon how to manage the economy? So that growth question will come back and haunt the administration in Beijing as well.
Dr. Ye Xie of Chatham House, thank you very much indeed. If you're interested in this subject, I really recommend The Clash of the Superpowers, the documentary series on BBC Two, on iPlayer now, Clash of the Superpowers, about that contest between China and the United States.
7 minutes to seven is the time now. An apology, plain and simple. That is what the Education Select Committee of the Commons is calling for today to women who were forced to put their children up for adoption after the Second World War. Such an apology has come from the governments in Wales and in Scotland, but not yet Westminster. According to the previous Conservative government, that was because the state wasn't directly responsible for the policy. Duncan Kennedy talked to Pat Tugwell, who is one of the many mothers forced to give up children.
I remember how awful, just how awful the nurses were. Really so rude and unpleasant because I was somebody who was having a baby and I wasn't married. That's terrible. It was a sin.
What would an official government apology mean to you now, all these years later?
I think it would help with some of the feelings that I'm feeling if somebody actually said, sorry, we could have done better, you know, we should have done better. I think that really would help.
Long time coming.
Long time coming.
Let's talk now to Duncan Kennedy. And Duncan, I was mentioning at the beginning, they have had the apology in Wales and in Scotland and also in Australia. I remember talking to you about it when you were based there for the BBC.
That's right. In 2013, that was the world's first apology. I always thought the whole phenomenon of forced adoptions couldn't just exist there. So when I got back to the UK, I investigated it further in 2021. We did some reports that led to the Commons Joint Committee on Human Rights setting up an investigation. They urged a government apology. It never happened. We did some more reports. Then Scotland and Wales did apologise. And now today, over the past couple of months, the Education Committee has taken another look at it and come to the conclusion that there were something like 185,000 people like Pat, who we've heard from there, who went from forced adoption, had pressured into giving up their babies, all kinds of horror stories they've heard in evidence over the past couple of months. And the Education Committee recommending today that the government should stop prevaricating and issue this official apology.
Why, though, given that previous governments, I think it was back in 2023, wasn't it, have decided that it wasn't government policy, it was done by other bodies, it might have been allowed by the government, but it wasn't government policy. So in those terms, the government, in a sense, I think they're saying, doesn't really have the right to apologise.
Yes, that's right. That was the argument of the previous Conservative government. That forced adoptions were a function of societal attitudes at the time, not state policy. But we've had an indication of the current government thinking from Josh McAllister, who's the children's minister, and who gave evidence to the Education Committee a couple of weeks ago. He said the government now accepts that the state was involved in two particular ways. First of all, it funded the church and charity groups that were behind this whole phenomenon of forced adoption, and the state failed to fund things like accommodation, which would have given the single mothers the option of holding on to their baby. And Josh McAllister said, the current government accepts that the state was involved in forced adoption. So that's a big change on the previous government. And he also said the government was now actively considering an official apology to set this right. And we've spoken to the birth mothers and adoptees, and they welcome that move forward.
So it is going to happen.
It's not there yet. They are cautiously optimistic. I think it would be quite, not a climb down, but it'd be quite a change of heart for the government to turn around and say, after all this potential encouragement, that actually we're not going to apologise, even though we believe the state was involved. I think it's heading in that direction. We're not there yet. These mothers say to us that they've campaigned for decades, they've had promises before that have never been delivered. They're cautiously optimistic, and they say it's only right that after decades and decades of campaigning, that they should see this justice and have their motherhood validated, is the way they put it, to put the shame and this scandal behind them.
Duncan, thank you for that. And we are actually talking to Josh McAllister later in the programme at 20 past 8 about other things, but hopefully I'll get the chance to talk to him about this as well and see what the programme potentially is now. Duncan Kennedy, thank you.
BBC Sounds. From hilarious history...
How tall is our King Gilgamesh?
I feel like back then they were just shorter anyway. So I think the lofty height of 5'11".
A giant among men.
To paranormal mystery.
There was a very strong sense of pure distilled evil.
And everything in between.
What are you thinking?
I don't mean generally. I mean on this one. That's not my business.
BBC Sounds. Packed with personality.
Time for the weather now. Here's Chris Fawkes.
Thanks a lot, Nick. And we've got a bit of a change in our weather picture today. For England and Wales, a band of rain is going to be pushing southwards, sunshine and showers following to Scotland and Northern Ireland later on. At the moment, the rain is coming down then across Northern England, Wales, getting into the Midlands and also Southwest England with a few heavy bursts of rain for Cumbria, Lancashire, Northern and Central parts of Wales as well. As we go through the day, this band of rain is going to push eastwards. So after a dry but pretty cloudy start to the day across Eastern England, we'll see rain arriving across East Anglia and Southeast England. And this afternoon looks quite damp, although the rain will be turning a little bit lighter and patchier later on. Meanwhile, for Scotland and Northern Ireland, a fine start to the day with spells of sunshine, a lot of dry weather initially. However, over the next few hours, we are going to see showers get going really quite quickly. And for Scotland and Northern Ireland, those showers become really widespread today, so a high chance of catching a downpour. Some of them will be heavy with some hail, even a bit of sleet over the hills of Scotland for a time. And late in the afternoon, as the weather brightens up across North England, the North Midlands and North Wales, we'll start to see one or two showers pushing in here as well. Temperatures close to average for the time of year. We're looking at highs of between 10 and 13 degrees, but just 7 for the Scottish Highlands and Islands. Tomorrow, more showers in the forecast, widespread across northern areas, and it'll become really quite windy as well.
Chris, thank you for that. You're listening to Today on Radio 4, Nick Robinson and Justin Webb.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 27th of March. The headlines this morning: President Trump has said he'll give Iran another 10 days to open the Strait of Hormuz before he attacks the country's energy plants, because he says talks are going well. Jeremy Bowen will give us his analysis after the news. Ministers are advising parents in England not to let children under 5 use screens for more than an hour a day. We'll be hearing from one of the child psychologists who has helped to shape that advice. And BBC News has been told the government will ask Lord Mandelson to hand over messages from his personal phone as it prepares to publish more files about his appointment as ambassador to the United States.
And coming up in this hour, what does Donald Trump's Republican base make of the war?
I trust Trump to know what he's doing.
I don't know that it's our job. I don't know that it should be our job, especially when you have so many people at home that can't afford basic things like groceries and gas.
We're here from Grapevine, Texas, and the annual gathering of the American Right. There may be a chill in the air, but it really is spring. The author Robert McFarlane is here to point us to nature's signs of hope.
Queen bumblebees clamber from their underground chambers, having simply slept the winter away. Lucky them. I find them lying on the sun-warmed tiles of our doorstep, panting like knackered rugby players in their striped jerseys, before lurching drunkenly into flight.
The BBC News read this morning by Alan Smith.
President Trump has said he will push back any bombing of Iran's energy facilities by a further 10 days. He threatened the attacks unless the country reopened the Strait of Hormuz to tankers. Mr. Trump said Iran had requested an extension to the deadline and he'd agreed because the talks were going well. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
Iran has denied that it asked for President Trump to delay attacks on the country's energy infrastructure, but he insisted the request was made. In a post on his Truth Social platform, he said the deadline would be extended until April the 6th, while the talks were ongoing. Speaking to Fox News, Mr. Trump suggested he was being generous to Iran in return for Tehran allowing several oil tankers, which he said were Pakistani-flagged, to move through the Strait of Hormuz, something he described as a present.
I gave them a 10-day period. They asked for 7. You're going to say, oh, Trump's a terrible negotiator. They asked for 7, and I said, I'm going to give you 10. Because they gave me ships. We talked about the 8 ships, you know, the president that I talked about the other day. But they asked for 7 and I gave them 10. You got 10 days. And they were very thankful about that.
But despite the pause, there are reports the US may be planning to escalate the conflict. The Wall Street Journal has suggested that Washington is considering deploying an additional 10,000 ground troops to the Middle East. The Pentagon has declined to comment.
Israel says it's carried out another wave of airstrikes in Tehran. Several explosions have also been heard in the south of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, where Israel has been attacking targets it says are linked to the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio is joining other foreign ministers from the G7 group of nations for talks in Paris. The US is expected to face pressure to de-escalate the conflict. From Paris, Hugh Schofield reports.
The other G7 nations are all partners of the United States, but they're also all very nervous about what President Trump has got into with his war on Iran. Nervous about oil prices and the effect on the world economy, and in some cases, like France and the UK, with alliances in the region, nervous too about getting sucked in militarily. At today's session, devoted to the Middle East conflict, Marco Rubio will be asked to set out the American position. What is the true state of negotiations with Iran and the American 15-point plan? Is Washington genuinely seeking to lessen tensions? What scenarios does President Trump have for ending the war? The other G7 nations are in the dark and want enlightening.
A report by MPs and peers has called for Britain to move away from its reliance on the United States for defence. Parliament's Joint Committee on National Security Strategy warns the UK must prepare for a worst-case scenario in which Europe can't rely on Washington in a crisis. It recommends greater European leadership of NATO and stronger relations with countries such as Australia, India and Canada. New government guidance for parents in England says children under the age of 2 shouldn't have any screen time by themselves. The advice for children between 2 and 5 is that viewing should be limited to a maximum of an hour a day. Sir Keir Starmer said the guidance, the first of its kind to be issued by ministers, would mean parents weren't left to face this battle alone. Here's our senior education reporter, Vanessa Clark.
This is the government's first evidence-backed practical advice for screen use for children under 5. It has previously said that around 98% of children are watching screens on a daily basis by the age of 2, and there's an impact on the language of those who use them the most. The guidance was developed by a panel led by the Children's Commissioner and the children's health expert, Professor Russell Viner. Alongside time limits, it recommends parents don't allow screen use at mealtimes or in the hour before bed. It says fast-paced videos should be avoided, as well as AI toys and tools. The advice also suggests all screen time is not equal, so watching or using screens together is much better for children's development than them watching alone. But the time limits don't apply to children with special educational needs and disabilities who use assistive technology.
BBC News understands the government will ask Lord Mandelson to hand over messages from his personal phone as part of the disclosure of documents about his appointment as ambassador to the US. The Cabinet Office is preparing to publish thousands more files after MPs backed their release last month, but so far it has only had access to Lord Mandelson's work phone. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
Government insiders insist they had always planned to ask Lord Mandelson for his personal messages. They say the move is not connected to the theft in October of the mobile owned by the Prime Minister's former Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney. There had been claims this device may have had messages between the two men. Gaining access to Lord Mandelson's personal mobile could help to patch together exchanges that the former US ambassador had with senior Labour figures. Officials are understood to be in possession of some messages between Lord Mandelson and Mr. McSweeney, but the government has refused to confirm whether others may have been lost. Yesterday, Sir Keir said conspiracy theories about the theft were a little far-fetched, but writing in The Telegraph, the Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch claimed there was something fishy going on and called for files around the theft to also be disclosed.
A Democratic congressman has made a direct plea to the former wife of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, Sarah Ferguson, to give evidence in the US about her close personal and business ties with the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. In a letter to Miss Ferguson, seen by the BBC, Sue Subramanian has also urged her to provide a congressional committee with any knowledge she had of the former Prince Andrew's involvement in Epstein's operations. Sarah Ferguson's representatives have been approached for comment, while Mr. Mountbatten Windsor has previously denied any wrongdoing. The government is being called on to make a formal apology to many thousands of women in England who were forced in the past to give up their babies because they weren't married. The Commons Education Committee said the practice of historical forced adoptions in the years after the Second World War caused unimaginable trauma for women and was devastating for their children. Duncan Kennedy reports.
The committee believes that around 185,000 babies were involved in forced adoptions between 1949 and 1976. 5 years ago, when the BBC first reported on it, the Joint Committee on Human Rights investigated the matter and called on the government to apologise. In 2023, the Scottish and Welsh governments did say sorry. In today's report, the Education Committee says forced adoptions amounted to systematic coercion and were inhumane. It says the government should end the heartache for mothers and adoptees and apologise.
Football, and Wales and Northern Ireland have both missed out on a place at this summer's World Cup in North America. Northern Ireland lost 2-0 to Italy in their semi-final playoff. Wales lost to Bosnia 4-2 on penalties when the match finished 1-1 after extra time. Our sports correspondent Andy Swiss was following the action.
Wales will not be at the World Cup this summer.
So near, yet so agonisingly far. The thousands of fans in Cardiff had been full of hope. A spectacular shot from Dan James, giving Wales a second-half lead. But after an equaliser from Edin Dzeko, it all came down to a penalty shootout, which Wales also led at first, but Nico Williams' effort was saved and Bosnia-Herzegovina held their nerve for victory. There was heartbreak too for Northern Ireland, as their hopes of qualifying for a first World Cup in 40 years were ended by Italy. Northern Ireland's manager Michael O'Neill took pride in his team's performance. The players gave everything, he said, but disappointment is part of football.
That was our sports correspondent Andy Swiss.
Thank you for that. It is 9 minutes past seven. Overnight developments in the war. Israel hitting Lebanon and Iran. Donald Trump saying he is further pausing his threat to obliterate energy targets in Iran. And reports in the Wall Street Journal that as many as 10,000 troops may be heading to the area, American troops, that is. Plus, in the last hour or so, Germany's foreign minister saying the United States and Iran have had indirect negotiations, as he put it, and the representatives from both sides are planning to meet shortly in Pakistan. Let us talk to our international editor, Jeremy Byrne, who is here in the studio. Jeremy, just on what the German foreign minister is saying, first of all, it looks, doesn't it, as if something is happening.
Yeah, I think that's clear. Clearly something is going on. Maybe there is a semantic debate about whether it's negotiations or contacts, but yes, it is certainly based on something. And I think it's the Iranians are people who always they're interested in a deal, but it has to be a deal that they like. And what we've heard so far about Trump's 15-point plan is that certainly the version that was leaked, I think, from Israeli sources actually read more like a surrender document. It had everything in it that both Israel and America have always asked of Iran, demanded of Iran, and Iran countered publicly by coming out with a whole list of its own demands, which are things which the other side couldn't accept. So on that basis, they're a long way apart.
And when you talk about Iran and Iran's demands, who? I mean, what do we know about the structure that there is at the moment in Iran?
I think the important thing to know about it, and there are some names, of course, there's a speaker and there's the new supreme leader, but I think the important thing to know about it is it's not really about names. It's about an institution, because the reason I think why the regime has proved to be so resilient is that unlike, say, Libya under Gaddafi, it has these institutions. It's not based on individuals. So if their system is institutionally based, it means that if individuals go, the institution plows on. For example, in Libya in 2011, after Gaddafi was killed and his family were kicked out, the institutions had been totally hollowed out by the regime and the whole thing collapsed. Something similar in Assad's Syria. Iran is a very different proposition.
One of the things that American supporters of the war were saying just before it kicked off was that it would be, in a sense, a bit like Venezuela, and they'd go there and they would discover not only that there was someone they could do business with in the old regime, but also that actually the rest of the regime was much more interested in criminality than it was in any kind of ideological commitment. But you're saying it's not ideological, it's bureaucratic commitment that seems to be happening.
It's a combination of things. The institutions are there, the ideology is there, an ironclad religious ideology, as well as nationalism, and as well as an ideology, an ethos of martyrdom and resistance and survival, coming from Iranian history, but also coming from the experience of 8 years of war with Iraq in the years after the Islamic Revolution of 1979, when Saddam Hussein went, basically tried to do them in, didn't succeed. But that experience, that forge, if you like, shaped a lot of the attitudes inside the Islamic Republic.
And now, talk in the United States of really large numbers of troops being sent to the area. What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, well, we know so far that there are two detachments of Marines on their way, 2,200 Marines on both of these amphibious Marine Expeditionary Units, maybe 3,000 paratroopers from the 82nd Airborne. We know about that. They're people that they're from a unit that can go anywhere in the world within 18 hours, apparently. But now they're talking about 10,000. That's a lot more. However, we have to remember that I think there were 160,000 combat troops available for the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and Iran is four times the size. They're not going to invade the country, but increasingly it's looking as if there isn't a deal, Trump will escalate, maybe take one of these strategic islands in the Gulf that the United States might go for. I mean, the thing is, I think it really is, you know, people talk a lot about inflection points. It feels like this at the moment, because if they cannot do a deal and Iran's big card is its control of the Strait of Hormuz, which is putting great economic pressure. If they can't do that, what can Donald Trump do? I think he will feel that he'll have to escalate, and escalating will mean involving these ground troops. And if you look as well at the way that they've had troop buildups around Venezuela and around Iran as well, when they're there, they tend to use them. But, you know, they make a lot of mistakes about the way they look at Iran. That's why they essentially thought it might be a Venezuela Mark II. It's a totally different proposition.
Jeremy Byrne, thank you.
It is now almost 7:15. One thing the Iranians have done in recent days is to taunt Donald Trump by suggesting his talk about talks is motivated largely by his worries about soaring oil prices and falling stock markets. Will is back in the studio. What a night it was on the markets. And the timing of what Donald Trump said about those talks was intriguing.
Yes, the way you set that up, Nick, just kind of raise a smile, doesn't it? 8:11 or 1:11 a.m. our time was that post on True Social from President Trump. The critical thing about that timing was it was 11 minutes after trading on Wall Street had finished for the day, and it was the worst single day of this entire conflict so far, not just for stocks, but also we saw the oil price rising quite sharply again, up 5% Brent crude was, problems in the US Treasury, so government borrowing, government debt as well, and other commodities too that obviously are the kind of bedrock of all things within the economy, building materials and stuff like that too. So yes, the timing, very interesting about this pause, and we're seeing actually on the futures market this morning, not regaining those losses from yesterday, but everything looking like it's going
to
open up.
He tends to talk as if America is insulated from this because they produce their own oil and gas largely, but he cannot be immune from concern.
America is one of the biggest importers, as we know, from tariffs of goods in the world, right? And I'm just looking literally at a flash that's coming down this morning on the Reuters news agency. Japanese companies being urged by the government to look for alternative sources of oil, and that they're buying oil on average at $140 to $200 a barrel. That is going into the price of everything, every television, every games console that an American household buys. So it's buying that inflation in, and not just in the US, of course, but here in Europe as well. So let's turn to what it might look like later on this morning here when markets open in London. And Russ Mould, Investment Director at AJ Bell, is with us. Russ, morning.
Good morning to you, Nick. That will.
The timing of that, first of all, did it raise your eyebrows too when President Trump decided to intervene?
He does seem to be very, very sensitive to where the stock market goes and where the price of gas on the US petrol forecourts goes and where particularly government borrowing costs go. I think that's probably an even bigger issue for him than the stock market. We saw last year after Liberation Day, nearly a year ago now, that you know, once share prices and bond prices started to fall, the US administration responded, and I suspect that the Iranians know that and they're probing those pressure points again.
And Nick making that point, the US economy not sealed off from what's going on. Neither us, of course, and the OECD earlier in the week suggesting that the UK economy may be, in their forecast, one of the worst hit, the worst hit by all of this. So what are you looking out for today, and what's it doing to our borrowing costs too?
I mean, the UK's borrowing costs have actually gone up more than America's in the last month. So the 10-year bond here, the gilt here in the UK, the yield that Chancellor Rachel Rees will be watching closely particularly, that's gone up by 70 basis points, 0.7% to just around 5%. That takes it back to the levels of January 2024, when everybody's 2025, when everybody's getting really, really worried about borrowing costs, and then back to 2008. So yes, financial markets are looking at the possible inflationary feed through. We're all looking at the oil and gas price, but there are already knock-on effects there. The price of urea, key feedstock for ammonium for nitrogen fertilizers, that's up 80% this year. We can already see wheat and soybean prices up a sixth. Corn prices are up by a quarter from their autumn lows. So if oil and gas prices stay high, the knock-on effects are becoming clear, and that will start to feed through to everything we see in the shops.
And we're starting to see that, aren't we, from, say, the big stock market, high street retailers, Next, yesterday, talking about £15 million of extra costs, as you say, sort of inputs into agricultural goods, building services, Travis Perkins as well. It's starting to go into things that people will see in their everyday lives, right, as well, not just the kind of the big economics, the overarching economics for the UK economy.
Correct. I mean, one thing that we will be watching is the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organizations Index. That's currently showing global food prices broadly flat and actually down on average by about a quarter from their 2022 highs, when oil, gas, fertilizer, commodity prices soared after the Russian attack on Ukraine. Certainly a lot of people will be watching that figure very, very closely now, A, if you're an economist, and B, if you're a shopper.
Ross Mould, Investment Director at AJ Bell. Thanks so much for your time.
And Will, thank you. Keep watching those markets, because it'll be interesting to see what happens in an hour's time or so when they open here in London. It is now 19 minutes past seven. Let's turn to the independent inquiry into grooming gangs. It's about to begin its work after that long and acrimonious row about whether it was needed at all, what it should examine and who should chair it. But a question being asked by MPs on the Home Affairs Select Committee in the Commons is whether vital records have already been destroyed in that time. One of those who is concerned is Chris Murray, Labour MP and member of that Home Affairs Select Committee. And he joins us now. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Nice to speak to you.
Concerned why, Mr. Murray?
Well, so it seems the Home Office hasn't written to local authorities to instruct them that they have to preserve all the papers in relation to this, which is concerning and almost to the point of being inexplicable. You know, this is something that should have happened quite automatically by the civil servants in the Home Office. So in June, Baroness Casey came to the Home Affairs Committee and announced that she was calling for a full inquiry, and it could have happened at that point. Then in November, the then Permanent Secretary of the Home Affairs Committee, Antonia Romeo, who's obviously now the Cabinet Secretary, came to the Home Affairs Committee, talked about her concerns about that department, how it was insular, how she had to institute measures for senior leadership to get a grip, how they had to improve process management. And we questioned her about that at the time. And we actually questioned the Home Secretary and the Deputy Permanent Secretary when they came earlier this year. All indications were that this happened, but it didn't. And that is inexplicable, because it should have been something that happened automatically.
This is more than a process problem, though, isn't it? Are you concerned that valuable evidence has been destroyed?
Well, I think that is a concern we have to have. Now, one issue is that hopefully mitigates that is when the Labour government came into office, the then Home Secretary Yvette Cooper instructed the police to review all closed cases and all cases that they hadn't prosecuted. So hopefully that will have caught some of this up. But actually the point here is that the Home Office should have done this anyway. And while the Home Secretary is obviously responsible for the full department, actually, this is not something that you can really hold ministers accountable for. This is something that should have been, and you know, the Home Secretary doesn't send every letter from that department. It's something about the functionality of that department and why that process didn't take place.
You mentioned that the woman who was permanent secretary, the top official at the department, is now the top civil servant in the country, the Cabinet Secretary Antonia Romeo. Are you suggesting she may have failed to do what was necessary?
I mean, we need to look into this, right? Because something should have happened. A routine task should have happened automatically. A senior civil servant at the top of the Home Office should have been responsible for the grooming gangs inquiry. And it should have been the moment that instruction was there, they should have automatically ensured that that went out. It's a routine task. Now, and what it speaks about is the sort of wider processes of the Home Office, the culture, the process management, the ability for senior leadership to get a grip. What we cannot have, which we've had far too often in the Home Office and we hear at the Home Affairs Committee all the time, is a kind of shrugging of the shoulders and the phrase, lessons will be learned. That actually, if the government here is trying to do some really significant reforms on Home Affairs, and they will not be able to achieve it if that Home Office is not up, is not fit for purpose.
Perhaps, Mr. Ori, it's part of a wider culture. We're talking about missing information. What do you make of the news that the mobile phone of the man who pushed for and oversaw the appointment of Lord Mandelson as ambassador to the United States, Keir Starmer's ex-chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, was stolen, along with all the relevant messages that an inquiry wants to see? Stolen, and it seems no proper effort was made to really get it back.
Well, I mean, people's phones get stolen. From what I've heard, he did report it to the police immediately. But the question here on the Home Office, if I can just go back to that.
No, don't go back to that, if you wouldn't mind, because you're a Labour MP. And it seems to me you're being very critical of civil servants. And as soon as I ask you about something that's embarrassing for your own party, you go, well, let's talk about the other subject. It's extraordinary, isn't it? The key advisor to Keir Starmer's phone is stolen weeks after he knows that the messages on it are vital to an inquiry into what went wrong with the appointment of Lord Mandelson. He gives and agrees with the police the wrong address for it. It appears no great effort is made to get it back, that the messages are not pursued from within Whitehall. It's pretty odd, isn't it?
Well, from what I understand from what happened here is someone's phone was stolen in London. It was immediately reported and the police did that process, and also government authorities were alerted as well, which sounds like the right process to happen. And I have to say, there is an issue in London where mobile phones are stolen all the time, and okay, it's a really systemic thing you've got dragged out on. But I'm not really
Nothing to see here, sorry, Mr. Barry.
Well, it sounds on the verges of a conspiracy theory to me, given that the much wider issues involved here are about protection of victims and making sure that we sort of get to the bottom of what happened there.
Chris Murray, thank you for joining us.
It is 24 minutes past seven. Where has spring gone? The Met Office says the weather is going to be turning increasingly unsettled in the coming days, but don't despair. Robert McFarlane, author and fellow of Emmanuel College, Cambridge, believes that beyond the weather, there is plenty in the springtime you might not have spotted, which can bring us hope.
Spring is the season of surfacing. Things that were buried begin to rise towards the light. Peony shoots shudder slowly free of soil and strive sunwards. Queen bumblebees clamber from their underground chambers, having simply slept the winter away. Lucky them. I find them lying on the sun-warmed tiles of our doorstep, panting like knackered rugby players in their striped jerseys, before lurching drunkenly into flight in an annual micro-comedy that always makes me smile. The future is already here, wrote William Gibson famously. It's just unevenly distributed. Spring, too. Brimstone butterflies and cherry blossom flutter the warm air in Sussex, while the mountains of northwest Scotland, where I am today, still bear shields of ice and deep snowfields. In this rapidly heating world of ours, ancient seasonal clocks are being jolted out of joint. The first flowering of the hawthorn, the first flight of an orange-tipped butterfly, the first arrival of a swallow. In England, the averaged date of these events is now 9 days ahead of what it was a century or so ago. Something is profoundly awry, and we sense it. To see bluebells flowering in mid-March feels uncanny, in the old sense of that word, meaning unhomely. I suspect most of you will have a personal, even a secret sign of spring, the subtle one you look or listen out for each year, the one that lifts the heart, that marks the season's start. Chiff-chaff song, maybe, or that rank, rich stink of wild garlic in the woods, or frog spawn's gelatinous seethe, or steam rising from wet tarmac when hot sun follows rain. For me, it's the first pink and white blossom on a small, gnarled apple tree in our little garden. That tree was grown from a pip gathered by a friend of mine, the writer Roger Deakin, from the apple orchards that grow on the slopes of the Tian Shan Mountains in Central Asia. He brought a handful of pips back in a black film canister, grew seedlings from them, and one of those became the tree that now flourishes in my garden. Roger died 20 years ago this year, but the tree is a living reminder of how his memory and his writing thrive on, rooting and branching and growing still. When I see that first flower on the apple tree, I feel the pang of missing Roger, but I also feel a brief blossoming of hope. We've done it. Another winter weathered, another spring sprung, once more round the sun, my friends.
Robert McFarlane there. You can hear more from him on Front Row on Tuesday about the film version of his book, Underland. Now, he was talking about signs of hope this springtime. He obviously wasn't watching the football, mate.
No, I think Northern Ireland and Wales fans this morning, Nick, will all be searching for those green shoots after what was, we have to say, a desperately disappointing night for both nations in World Cup qualifying. Wales were beaten on penalties in Cardiff by Bosnia and Herzegovina, meaning Craig Bellamy's side miss out on the playoff final for the World Cup next Tuesday.
Very disappointed. You know, it's not the hard luck Wales run. We expect to be at major tournaments, or we really push ourselves to be there. There was a lot good tonight that really gives a good opportunity of being here, but it wasn't to be.
And we'll have more reaction from that Wales defeat in the next hour of the programme. Meanwhile, there was further heartbreak for Northern Ireland in Bergamo.
The referee blows the final whistle. Italy make it through to the playoff final.
Of course they're disappointed. For some of the older lads, this chance won't come again. For a lot of the younger ones, it will. But disappointment's part of football. It's part of the journey they're on. You know, for us to come here to Italy, give the performance like that with a team of that age is a real positive for the team going forward.
Obviously the disappointment, but it's a good experience to go through if you think of it long term with the young team that we have. And obviously with young teams, you can have that inconsistency, but we're only going to get better.
That is the Northern Ireland manager Michael O'Neill and captain Trey Hume there reacting to a 2-0 defeat to Italy out in Bergamo. Delighted to say we can speak to the former Northern Ireland striker Connor Washington, who was watching last night. Morning, Connor.
Morning, how are you?
Yeah, we're okay. Just not to be, was it, for Northern Ireland? They held their own, didn't they, against the Italians? Kept it goalless till almost the hour mark, but in the end, I guess, the Italian quality told.
Yeah, exactly that. Totally agree with you. Just two bits of quality. And then unfortunately, nothing seemed to drop the other way. And at this level, you need a little bit of luck and a little bit of quality.
And Northern Ireland without, we should say, two of the best players as well, Dan Ballard and Conor Bradley. You know, for a nation of limited resources to be without two of your star names away to former world champions Italy was, I guess, always going to be a tall order.
Yeah, two massive misses. I mean, Dan, for his defensive work, as much as what he does at the other end of the pitch in terms of set-piece situations, and Conor Bradley's obviously, he's been an absolute revelation for Northern Ireland down that side, and is a massive attacking threat as well. So, yeah, you couldn't have picked two worse players, really.
Are there some green shoots, as we were saying, for Northern Ireland, though? We heard Michael O'Neill there talk about the young age of his side. Do you expect this side, this group of players, to get better and make a real fist of qualifying for the next major tournament, the Euros in 2028?
Yeah, for sure. When I look back, I mean, the Euros and then the two sort of failed qualifying campaigns that we almost got to the playoffs in were massive for me personally as a player. So, yeah, like, sort of echoing what the manager says, and also what Trey's alluding to there, is it's a real positive. They know what it takes. They've seen the level. They've seen how fine margins are. So it can only be a good thing going into the next few campaigns, especially, like you say, with such a young group.
Just briefly, do you expect Michael O'Neill to stay manager as Northern Ireland? He is currently managing Blackburn Rovers in the Championship as well. Bit of a job share for him. He's contracted in Northern Ireland, I think, till 2028. Are you expecting him to manage the side for the next campaign?
Probably more hope than expectation, to be fair, but I think he's been such a fantastic manager for Northern Ireland, and it would be a real shame to lose him. But obviously at some point we sort of are going to have to move on. Hopefully it's not before 2028, but hope more than expectation.
Well, we shall see. Many thanks for your time this morning. That is the former Northern Ireland striker, Conor Washington, reflecting on their defeat. As we say, we'll get the Welsh perspective in the next hour of the programme. And the Republic of Ireland as well also lost last night. They were 2-0 up on the Czech Republic, but ended up going out on penalties. So disappointing night all round. England, should say, play their friendly against Uruguay later at Wembley this evening.
Mike, thank you for that. Next week on Radio 4, the legacy of the walls that divided a community for 25 years.
In the 1930s, in a neighbourhood in Oxford, walls were built to separate communities.
A red brick wall between 8 to 9 feet with these spikes.
To stop the people from the working class area walking through the middle class area.
Then, almost 70 years ago, the walls came down.
We're a very small pocket of deprivation surrounded by immense wealth.
I'm Polly Weston, and in my new series, I'm exploring the legacy of those walls today.
People should know that this did happen.
The Shadow of the Cutslow Walls on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. next Monday to Friday at 1:45.
What has the spring got in store for us today? Cloud and rain is going to push across southern areas, becoming confined to the southeast later on, turning brighter behind this. But the northwest will be windy with showers, wintry on the hills.
Coming up in the next half hour, toddlers and screens. Naughty, says the government. We'll be discussing new government guidance on how much screen time for children is healthy.
It is now 27 minutes to 8. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson. And Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
President Trump has said he will push back any bombing of Iran's energy facilities by a further 10 days. He threatened the attacks unless the country reopened the Strait of Hormuz to tankers. In a post on social media, Mr. Trump said Iran had requested an extension and he'd agreed because the talks were going well. Iran's denied asking for a delay. The German foreign minister says he received information that there have been indirect contacts between the US and Iran and preparations are being made for them to meet directly in Pakistan. Israel says it's carried out another wave of airstrikes in Tehran. Several explosions have also been heard in the south of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, where Israel has been attacking targets which it says are linked to the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah. A report by MPs and peers has called for Britain to move away from its reliance on the United States for defence. Parliament's Joint Committee on the National Security Strategy recommends greater European leadership of NATO. New government guidance for parents in England says children under the age of 2 shouldn't have any screen time by themselves. The advice for children between 2 and 5 is that viewing should be limited to a maximum of an hour a day. The Competition and Markets Authority says it's opened an investigation into 5 businesses over allegations of fake and misleading reviews online, saying it will try to determine whether they have infringed consumer law. It says the 5 firms in question are Auto Trader, FIFO, Dignity and Just Eat and Pasta Evangelists. And BBC News understands the government will ask Lord Mandelson to hand over messages from his personal phone as part of the disclosure of documents about his appointment as ambassador to the US. The Cabinet Office is preparing to publish thousands more files, but so far it has only had access to Lord Mandelson's work phone.
Alan, thank you. It is 25 to 8 now. Let's turn to that new official advice for parents about their children's screen time. Children under 2 should not have any time watching a screen on their own. Under 5 should be limited to an hour a day. That at least is what the officials, ministers at the Department for Education in Westminster are telling parents in England. But what's the basis for that advice and will parents pay any attention to it? We're going to hear from one of those who helped to develop it, a child psychologist in a moment, from the minister in charge after 8 o'clock. But first, our senior education reporter, Vanessa Clark, has been following one family in Manchester in their quest to cut down the screen time.
That's my cat.
Yeah, but that's Ryan.
So my name's Alexis, and we've got 2 boys. Romy, who's nearly 5, and Marlo is nearly 2 in May. So
it's a busy house.
Yeah. Yeah, it's mad.
Only allowed to use.
For the Montastier family, who live here in Manchester, life is a juggle.
Is there any playing?
From school and nursery pickup to dinner time.
Maybe mac and cheese or something.
Their home is filled with technology, and screen time is something that happens more often than the family would like.
Yeah, it does make me feel guilty for doing it, and I always feel like it's not what we should be doing, but what are you going to do? You're not going to be always getting out of bed bouncing with them at 6 o'clock and setting up an art and crafts table.
Do you think you do have screens and games on too much? Are you conscious of it, or do you think
I am conscious for sure? It's on my mind every day, but at the same time, it's just like you've got other pressures, and most of the time, it is to avoid conflicts, meltdowns, and to give yourself a bit of a break.
Over the next week, the Montastiers are keen to cut back on screen time, swapping mobile devices and TV for books, toys and other activities.
Only ever is an iPad.
And for Romy, it is going to be a big change.
What do you do with your iPad?
I like to do Angry Birds games. And there's a big pig tower where all the pigs are, and then there's the thing where there's just...
1 week later, I check back in to see how they've been getting on.
It's been interesting, to say the least. At the start of the week, I was like, yeah, come on, we're going to do this. And by the end of the week, no screen or everything will just swap perfectly. But it didn't happen. We've tried our best, but I think, yeah, I've been conscious of it for a while. This has definitely made me more aware and almost made me start doing things that I've always said, oh, we need to do that.
For Romy, I'm not sure he's totally convinced, but there were definitely some highlights.
Dancing in the morning.
Was that better than the iPad?
Yes.
Took a bit of time for Romy to answer that question from our education reporter, Vanessa Clark there. Let's turn to Professor Sam Wass, Director of the Institute for the Science of Early Years and one of the UK's leading experts on early year brain development. Good morning to you, Professor Wass.
Morning, Nick.
It was very telling, wasn't it, the words of that mother. Been interesting, we've tried our best. This is a real struggle for parents.
It is, and it's something where, you know, parenting has just changed so fast, so rapidly. You know, when I was a child, you know, television was accessible in the living room, but it was only on for certain hours of the day. Whereas now, you know, since we've had kind of TV, iPads being widespread, we've had, you know, the massive increase, more than doubling in the last 15 years of the amount of screen time. And they're really high levels nowadays. So a recent DfE study found that the average 2-year-old watches about 2 hours, 10 minutes per day, with the top 20%. So that's 150,000 2-year-olds watching an average of 5 hours a day of content. So, you know, it's so convenient and it's so ingrained in our lives now, but these changes have happened so fast that, you know, frankly, when we've been putting together the guidance, you know, we've reviewed the evidence very, very carefully for what there is, but we're frankly an area where the science is struggling to keep up just with the rate of change.
Well, tell us what the science does tell us, because it's not just how much is watched for how long, but what is watched.
Yeah, definitely, that's coming through really strongly, and that's one thing that we do know, which is that the needs of young brains are very different to the needs of older children. So, you know, basically our brains are prediction machines. So we're constantly trying to guess what we're going to see or hear next before we hear it, see it or hear it. And that helps us to perceive things. And young brains don't have so much prior experience, so they can't predict so well what they're going to see or hear next, which makes them much slower and much less efficient. And we know that when they're in a situation where they can't predict what's going to happen next, when they're overwhelmed, then we go into this kind of high alert mode, fight or flight, which, you know, I'd say is probably why you get these links between screens and behavioral dysregulation that are coming through so strongly from the research. So there are some really, really interesting areas here. I mean, frankly, Nick, there's one thing that puzzles me. You know, I do a lot of research into this, is the bit that we really don't understand is why children are so drawn to screens. So we know that screens aren't as effective for early learning as face-to-face interaction. And, you know, as I've been saying, we know that they cause stress. They cause this fight or flight response. But what we don't understand is why children are so drawn to them. And that's the bit that, frankly, we really, really need to figure out.
So in a sense, these guidelines are precautionary because there isn't the evidence there to support a particular number of minutes or hours. There's a bigger question, though, isn't there? What difference will a recommended limit from a government department make? It is not what parents are going to spend much time thinking about, is it?
Yeah, that is true. One of the really interesting things that I reflect on a lot is this idea of, you know, shared engagement. And now, all of the research into, you know, the effects of parenting on, sorry, how best to promote a child's attention is that shared engagement is by far the most effective way to do it. There's some lovely research by my colleague Daniel Matthews at the University of Sheffield with CBeebies that communication interventions are actually more effective during infancy than toddlerhood. And we were saying that maybe that's because early on it's easier to get parents into this habit of, you know, thinking that your child is someone who can be talked to, who, you know, can point out something interesting that you haven't noticed, you know, rather than this trap which we all get into of, you know, sitting, living parallel lives, staring at our individual screens and, you know, occasionally kind of barking out instructions when there's something that we need. So it's a really, really hard to shift these habits. You're absolutely right about
that. But do you think guidelines make any difference to that, I suppose, is my question. I know you didn't draw up the guidelines your own. You were one of the people who influenced it. But, you know, clearly we get all sorts of advice about what we eat, for example, about the need to wear seatbelts. Some of them effective, like seatbelts, but it's also legally enforced. Arguably 5 a day and so on when it comes to fruit and veg makes not that much difference, does it? Is this really going to affect conversations at home? You can't do it. The government says you can only have an hour a day.
Yeah, well, what we're trying to do is to think about screen swaps. So actually into the guidance, we've put some things about, you know, things you can be, you know, talking about at a mealtime rather than kind of having screens. And you know, the thing that I think is really important here, Nick, is that, you know, shared engagement. You know, I've got 3 young kids and I live a very busy life, and I really, really have to force myself sometimes to, you know, in the morning when you're getting ready, getting everything together and you're in a big hurry, to actually get down on the floor with them and look at the world from their perspective and just be engaged in what they're interested in. And the thing that, you know, is, I think, is really, really important to get across is that this helps your own mental health too. You know, you'll get so caught up in your own worries and your own high-speed, high-paced adult life, that actually to get down and slow yourself down to the pace of a young child, even if it's just for a couple of minutes in the morning, it's very evidence-based that it helps the child, but it also helps you too.
some help and some support rather than a series of strict guidelines by the sounds of it. Professor Sam Wass, Director of the Institute for the Science of Early Years. Thank you very much indeed. We'll hear from the Minister at about 20 past eight.
Time now is 18 minutes to eight. It's been nearly four full weeks since the joint US military campaign against the Iranian regime began, while public opinion polls show that the war is unpopular in America. Donald Trump's Republican base has been largely unified in its approval. That might be changing, though. At the annual Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, where Reza Pahlavi, the son of the late Shah of Iran, is due to speak, there are signs that some of Trump's supporters are beginning to have doubts, as the BBC's Anthony Zerker reports from Grapevine, Texas.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome CPAC 2026.
CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, is an annual gathering of right-wing politicians, activists, engaged voters, and various hangers-on. It's traditionally been held in Washington, D.C., but this year, it's near Dallas in the Republican-dominated state of Texas.
You all want to send D.C. a message? Let him hear from you.
We may be more than 1,000 miles from the nation's capital, but the war in Iran still dominated much of the conversation here, both on the main stage.
Ladies and gentlemen, up next, MAGA versus Mullah Madness.
And among the throngs that filled the convention center.
Regime change for Iran! Regime change for Iran!
Behind me, some of the people who filled the halls earlier today at CPAC to listen to a panel on Iran are now chanting King Reza Pahlavi, thank you Trump, and regime change for Iran. There's a very active group of people calling for regime change here at CPAC, and I think that reflects some of the support that is going to show up here for Pahlavi.
I don't know. I just I trust Trump to know what he's doing.
That's Penny Crosby, a member of the Trump Tribe of Texas, CPAC regulars who showed up in matching gold sequin jackets. She, along with Michael Manuel Rayad and Blake Zumo, were unwavering in their support for the president.
If there's a threat for the United States getting bombed with a nuclear bomb, who can say no to that?
I mean, he's protecting us.
He's protecting the American people.
They chant all the time, kill big Satan and little Satan. They're coming after us. We are big Satan. They're coming for us.
Do you think this war should keep going on until the leadership, the regime in Iran is out of power, or do you think there's a way of wrapping it up before then?
He can't just quit. He's not going to stop until he finishes.
He needs to finish the job.
Some of the younger conference attendees, like Toby Blair, a 19-year-old college student from Florida, were more skeptical when it came to Iran.
I don't know that it's our job. I don't know that it should be our job, especially when you have so many people at home that can't afford basic things like groceries and gas.
His friend, Shashank Yalamanchi, a first-year law student, had similar concerns.
Honestly, a war with Iran is not what we need right now. The market's about to go into chaos with AI. Do we need it to go into more chaos over, you know, Hormuz or any oil supply or energy disruption? I would prefer to scale back the conflict and let our Arab allies handle more of the fight.
A floor down from the main stage, the exhibit hall was buzzing with games and filled with vendors. That's where I met Samantha and Joe, who live in Dallas and were at their first CPAC. They also had their doubts about the war.
Trump campaigned on no new wars, and yet here we are with a new war. So you're like, where did the campaign promises go? And I think that'd be my biggest question.
I'm very worried about the boots on the ground thing, too. You got two expeditionary units of the Marine Corps going there and the 82nd Airborne Division. I can't see that as being good. I'll just say that.
Right. He talks about finding an exit, winding things down.
That's just escalating it.
King is speaking. Hear what we say.
King Reza Pahlavi.
Outside the convention center, Iranian activists were waving flags, playing music, and cheering at passing cars. While some CPAC attendees may be unsure of how this war fits with an America First agenda, their voices have been quiet compared to the Iranians here who believe this is a war worth fighting.
Anthony Zerker there reflecting on how the conservative movement is reacting to the war. In just a minute, we're going to be talking about what it will mean for business back here at home after that rather grim economic forecast yesterday. Before that, though, at 13 minutes to 8, it is time for Thought for the Day. The speaker with us in the studio this morning is the Bishop Richard Harris. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. I recently came across a new term,
chronically terminal. Janice Chen has stage 4 lung cancer, and writing in The Guardian, she describes how every day is a great struggle to go on. She lives in what she calls the long middle, the period between first diagnosis and the time when she'll finally pass from this life, a time that is chronically terminal. But still a time for living, of living as best she can. As 3.5 million people in the UK live with cancer, and there are 400,000 new cases a year, many will resonate with her situation. In this beautifully written piece, she describes the effect of illness on people's religious belief, or lack of belief. She said that she found herself back in church on Sundays. Faith furnished me with a different architecture for endurance. It offered a vocabulary of hope. But she also notes that a member of her support group, who previously had a faith, lost it totally as a result of the illness. They couldn't understand why it had happened to them. To some, the diagnosis is a clarifying fire that burns away the trivial, leaving a refined spiritual core. To others, it's an acid dissolving everything they once held. What the illness has done for her, more than anything else, has sharpened her discernment. As she put it, it leaves only the essential, revealing that meaning resides entirely in the quality of our attention. To walk through a park, to watch the sunlight catch a river, or to register the laughter of children against the thrum of a passing bus, is to realise that these are no longer background noise, they are the destination. Particularly at this time of year, with trees budding and blossom coming out, what she writes seems particularly pertinent. And it brought to mind a famous interview between Melvyn Bragg and the playwright Dennis Potter as he was dying. Dennis Potter said that when he looked out of the window, he didn't just say, "Oh, that's nice blossom. I see it, the whitest, frothiest, blossomest blossom that there ever could be, and I can see it. The nowness of everything is absolutely wondrous." It's this living in the moment that the discipline of mindfulness is trying to achieve, whatever stage of life we're at. Father Pierre de Caussure, writing in the first half of the 18th century, called it the sacrament of the present moment. The sacrament of the present moment. For him, however, it was not just about experiencing the present more intensely, but being open and receptive to what might be being asked of us in that moment. In every now there was, he taught, a providence to be discerned and responded to.
That was Thought for the Day with Bishop Richard Harris. It is now 10 to 8.
Increased energy prices because of the war in the Middle East don't just hit households, they hit businesses, they hit them hard, and they hit them while they're already complaining that energy costs in this country are way more than in comparable countries, and that in part is a choice because of government net zero policy. The OECD, the Club of Richer Nations, is warning this morning that Britain will suffer more than the others from the energy price rises to come because we import so much. And of course, we tax a lot too. You'll have seen the boss of Marks and Spencer, Stuart Machin, saying this week that these are the tariffs that the government place on our bills to fund their policies and have nothing to do with the price of oil or gas. They now make up, he said, over half of our bill, over half of Marks and Spencer's energy bill is effectively taxed. Not sustainable, he says, for UK businesses. Let us talk to Jane Somerville, who's Managing Director of Bowers & Jones, a makers of rolling mill components, and to Kate Shoesmith as well, Director of Policy at the British Chambers of Commerce. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Just a word, first of all, Jane Somerville, about what Stuart Machin is saying at Marks & Spencer's. You presumably would back that.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, we've seen our energy costs rise constantly over the last sort of 5 years. We are still paying more than double in terms of electricity costs than what we were before the Ukraine conflict. And we've suffered another increase now because of the Iran war. It's just another cost that the business has to endure over and above everything else that's going up because of the Iran war, such as our fuel oil for the heating of the factory has gone up, our transport costs have gone up, our raw material costs are going up. And also it's affecting our machine consumables and coolants and things. So it's not just about energy for small businesses. It's absolutely everything that's going up. And I think the government doesn't really realise that. And small businesses are the backbone of this economy. And a lot of them are struggling now. And there's just too many small businesses just deciding to give up.
Kate Shoesmith, what would you say specifically about the energy side of it at the moment?
I can only agree with what Jane was saying there, that we've seen this across the board. So when we talk to members of the British Chambers of Commerce up and down the country, what they're saying is that they're finding that their energy costs are already rising. So it's not just about necessarily thinking about whether your contract's up for renewal. We have members that, for instance, use heating oil because they are in remote rural areas. Speaking to a restaurant that was on the Norfolk coast, so they're off the grid, and their heating oil costs in a couple of days after the conflict, they went up 300%. So there are specific instances where we're seeing energy prices, not just your normal gas and electricity, going up already.
The government seems to suggest, Kate Shoesmith, that eco-charges, the kind of eco-charges that people pay through their bills, and to some extent have been removed from bills now, haven't they, and put into general taxation, those charges don't apply so much to business. What is the experience of business when it comes to what they think they are having to pay and the division between what they're actually paying for the energy and what they're paying in taxes?
When you look at it, there's no doubt that your energy prices have gone up across the board. So there's no comparison of what it was like pre-Russia invading in Ukraine. It is just the cumulative impact of year-on-year increases. Businesses are finding that a particular struggle. You're specifically asked to concentrate on energy, but it's not just about the energy costs. When you look at it, there's so many businesses that are facing reevaluation for business rates. They're thinking about national minimum wage is going up again this April, and they've been going up 25% over the last 3 years. So there's so many costs that are facing businesses, and energy is just not the same as it was even 3 years ago.
Jane Somerville, I mean, when the government came into power, it very specifically said it understood the concerns of business and also, of course, desperately wants growth. Can you see a strategy?
Absolutely not. I mean, they're saying that they want growth in the economy, but every action that they take makes that more difficult for small businesses to grow or for any business to grow. So they're saying one thing, but doing the opposite.
One of the things I was reading earlier in the week, Kate Shoesmith, that involves a greater number of businesses now, or the idea is that it will involve them, for instance, is in reporting things about the business. One of the things that they're going to be asked to report potentially is on the number of disabled people that they employ. The government's very keen to get more disabled people into work, something a lot of people think is a very good idea. On the other hand, this person who runs a small business was also saying, well, if you have to report pay differentials with disabled people involved in that, then some businesses are going to look bad because they've just been taken on and they're taken on in the bottom rungs of the business, so they may not do it. In other words, there's an incoherence when it comes to the bureaucracy that is imposed upon business. And I suppose that's not necessarily a political thing with this government. It's just governments, plural, do that.
So we've had gender pay reporting for a while now, and there is moves towards thinking about how do we have pay reporting for other groups across the population. And most of that reporting is targeted at larger businesses, so businesses with over 250 employees. It's absolutely right. If we're thinking about how do we get more people into work, how do we create the right jobs, and how do we ensure that we are then all paying taxes, that we're thinking about how do we bring everybody with us. But the very first and foremost priority has to be how do we get to the growth. So what are we doing to ensure that businesses can survive this time? When we talk to businesses, they tell us that they want to grow, but the conditions around them are really difficult. They're finding it particularly difficult to tread water at the minute because of now this uncertainty around what's going to happen with their energy prices. Ofgem was saying that about a third of businesses may be renewing their energy contracts this year. So those are the types of measures where we've really got to focus in and think, what can government do? Is it about providing better advice? How can we provide support? And how can we keep looking at the costs and what we can do there to support the businesses that are most vulnerable?
Final thought then, James Somerville at Burrs and Jones. What do you need? In what is the single thing that the government could either change course on or provide or do or not do, indeed, that would get you out of the mess that you say you're in?
What we need is just stability. If we could just have stability for a certain period of time, then we could put plans in place and then action those plans to move forward and grow. But we just don't. We haven't. I took the business over in 2020, and since then it has been a roller coaster of challenges we've had to overcome just to tread water. It is, you know, stability is the main thing that we need.
Jane Somerville and Kate Shoesmith as well. Thank you both.
It is coming up to 8:02. Alex Forsyth joins us with details of tonight's Any Questions.
Hello, morning, Nick. Tonight we are in Northumberland, in the town of Ponteland, 7 miles or so from Newcastle. Joining me there to discuss developments this week, whether international or domestic, will be a plethora of politicians. Anna Turley is the chair of the Labour Party. Baroness Tina Stoll is a Conservative peer and former minister. Rachel Millwood is a deputy leader of the Green Party of England and Wales. And Darren Grimes sits on the board of Reform UK. I reckon it might be lively. So join us if you can, 8 p.m. here on Radio 4.
Let us go to the weather. It comes from Chris Fawkes this morning.
Thanks, Justin. And we're looking at an unsettled day of weather. A band of rain is going to be pushing its way southwards and eastwards across England and Wales. The rain already with us for North England, the Midlands, Wales, getting into southwest England. We'll continue pushing into the south and east. So East Anglia, southeast England, getting the rain late morning or into the afternoon. But by this stage, the rain should be turning lighter and patchier in nature. What's following to Scotland and Northern Ireland is a mixture of sunshine and showers today. The showers will be widespread, so there is a high chance of catching a downpour or two during the day, and a number of those showers, particularly this afternoon, will be heavy with some hailstorms around, and locally they could give a complete covering of hail on roads and pavements, particularly for parts of northern and western Scotland. It will turn quite windy for Scotland later on today, particularly for northern and western areas, with gusts of wind reaching around 40 to 50 miles an hour. Our temperatures nationwide close to average, 10 to 13 degrees, but just 7 today for the Hebrides, for Orkney, Shetland and Highland as well. Now, looking at the weather picture into the weekend, it stays pretty windy. Some strong winds for northern Scotland, reaching around 50 to 65 miles an hour tomorrow. Tomorrow is a day of sunshine and showers, and again, a number of those showers will have hail mixed in, some sleet and snow over some of the highest hills in Scotland as well. That's the latest.
Thank you, Chris. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson.
It's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 27th of March. The headlines this morning. President Trump has said he'll delay his threat to obliterate Iranian energy plants for a further 10 days. The German foreign minister has suggested this morning that preparations are taking place in Pakistan for representatives of the US and Iran to meet. We'll be hearing the analysis of the former MI6 boss, Sir John Sawyers, after the news. Parents in England are being told by the government that children under 5 should have less than an hour a day screen time. We've been hearing from a family doing their best to cut down on screens.
It's on my mind every day, but at the same time, it's just like you've got other pressures, and most of the time it is to avoid conflicts, meltdowns, and to give yourself a bit of a break.
In 20 minutes or so, we'll be hearing from the government on that. Plus, the Competition and Markets Authority has launched an investigation into 5 companies, including Auto Trader and Just Eat, as part of a crackdown on fake online reviews.
Also coming up each day on this programme, we try to equip you with the information you need, the facts, the arguments, the debates you want to make sense of the world and have some sense of what might happen next. But how good are we actually at it? We'll discuss that. That's all after the BBC News with Alan Smith.
President Trump has said he will push back any bombing of Iran's energy facilities by a further 10 days. He'd threatened the attacks unless the country reopened the Strait of Hormuz to tankers. Mr. Trump said Iran had requested an extension to the deadline and he'd agreed because the talks were going well. The German foreign minister says he's received information that there have been indirect contacts between the US and Iran and preparations are being made for them to meet directly in Pakistan. Here's our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
Iran has denied that it asked for President Trump to delay attacks on the country's energy infrastructure, but he insisted the request was made. In a post on his Truth Social platform, he said the deadline would be extended until April the 6th, while the talks were ongoing. Speaking to Fox News, Mr. Trump suggested he was being generous to Iran in return for Tehran allowing several oil tankers, which he said were Pakistani flagged, to move through the Strait of Hormuz, something he described as a present.
I gave them a 10-day period. They asked for 7. You're going to say, oh, Trump's a terrible negotiator. They asked for 7, and I said, I'm going to give you 10, because they gave me ships. We talked about the 8 ships, you know, the president that I talked about the other day. But they asked for 7, and I gave them 10. You got 10 days, and they were very thankful about that.
But despite the pause, there are reports the U.S. may be planning to escalate the conflict. The Wall Street Journal has suggested that Washington is considering deploying an additional 10,000 ground troops to the Middle East. The Pentagon has declined to comment.
Israel says it's carried out another wave of airstrikes in Tehran. Several explosions have also been heard in the south of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, where Israel has been attacking targets, it says, are linked to the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah. A report by MPs and peers has called for Britain to move away from its reliance on the United States for defence. Parliament's Joint Committee on the National Security Strategy warns the UK must prepare for a worst-case scenario in which Europe can't rely on Washington in a crisis. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams.
This report asks some now familiar questions. Is the UK doing enough to adjust to a new reality in which the US has a reduced security presence in Europe? Are we too dependent on American intelligence and military capabilities? And should we be getting ready for what the report calls a worst-case scenario in which Europe can no longer rely on US support? The report says strategic collaboration with the US should continue where practical, but that the UK and its European allies must develop a clear plan for a transition towards greater European leadership of NATO.
Parents in England are being advised not to let under-fives watch screens for more than an hour a day. New government guidance also says that children under 2 shouldn't be allowed to watch screens unless they're accompanied by adults. Sir Keir Starmer said the advice, the first of its kind to be issued by ministers, would mean parents weren't left to face this battle alone. An expert on early years brain development, Professor Sam Wass, told us there was still a lot more that scientists needed to understand.
One thing that puzzles me, you know, I do a lot of research into this, is the bit that we really don't understand is why children are so drawn to screens. So we know that screens aren't as effective for early learning as face-to-face interaction. And, you know, as I've been saying, we know that they cause stress. They cause this fight or flight response. But what we don't understand is why children are so drawn to them. And that's the bit that, frankly, we really, really need to figure out.
The Competition and Markets Authority says it's opened an investigation into 5 businesses over allegations of fake and misleading reviews online, saying it will try to determine whether they've infringed consumer law. Here's Shona McCallum.
The CMA says it's concerned that online reviews may have given customers a misleading picture. The companies under scrutiny include Auto Trader, Just Eat, funeral provider Dignity, customer review platform Fifo, and the restaurant chain Pasta Evangelists. The regulator is examining how the reviews were obtained and displayed, whether negative reviews were hidden, star ratings inflated, or if customers were offered incentives to leave positive feedback without this being made clear. All of these could have influenced people's decisions on whether to make a purchase. The CMA says fake reviews undermine consumer trust at a time when household budgets are under pressure. Under new consumer laws introduced last year, if a company has broken the rules, it could be required to change their business practices or face fines of up to 10% of their global turnover.
BBC News understands the government will ask Lord Mandelson to hand over messages from his personal phone as part of the disclosure of documents about his appointment as ambassador to the US. The Cabinet Office is preparing to publish thousands more files after MPs backed their release last month. But so far, it's only had access to Lord Mandelson's work phone. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
Government insiders insist they had always planned to ask Lord Mandelson for his personal messages. They say the move is not connected to the theft in October of the mobile owned by the Prime Minister's former Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney. There had been claims this device may have had messages between the two men. Gaining access to Lord Mandelson's personal mobile could help to patch together exchanges that the former US ambassador had with senior Labour figures. Officials are understood to be in possession of some messages between Lord Mandelson and Mr. McSweeney, but the government has refused to confirm whether others may have been lost. Yesterday, Sir Keir said conspiracy theories about the theft were a little far-fetched, but writing in The Telegraph, the Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch claimed there was something fishy going on and called for files around the theft to also be disclosed.
A Democratic congressman has made a direct plea to the former wife of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, Sarah Ferguson, to give evidence in the US about her close personal and business ties with the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. In a letter seen by the BBC, Sua Subramanian also urges Ms. Ferguson to provide a congressional committee with any knowledge she had of the former Prince Andrew's involvement in Epstein's operations. Sarah Ferguson's representatives have been approached for comment, while Mr. Mountbatten Windsor has previously denied any wrongdoing. Here's our royal correspondent, Noor Nanji.
Suha Subramaniam, a member of the House Oversight Committee, said the Epstein files had revealed Sarah Ferguson's close links with the disgraced financier. He said it was clear she could assist the committee's investigation and set a two-week deadline for her to respond. There's no legal mechanism to compel her to testify in the US, and being named in the Epstein files is not an indication of wrongdoing. But the letter shows the pressure the former Duchess is facing from the other side of the Atlantic.
Figures show that retail sales fell by 0.4% last month compared with January. The Office for National Statistics says there was a drop in supermarket sales and wet weather reduced demand for household goods. In the 3 months to February, sales volumes rose by 0.7%, driven by strong online sales. In Australia, hundreds of petrol stations have been running out of fuel as demand from motorists surges because of the war in the Middle East. The government there has urged people not to panic buy. Our correspondent Simon Atkinson is at a petrol station in Cairns in northeast Australia.
This small independent garage tells a pretty typical story in Australia. It's out of unleaded petrol and the price of diesel is 85% higher than it was before the war. In New South Wales, the most populous state, one in seven retailers say they're out of at least one type of fuel. The government insists supplies haven't actually fallen and the shortfalls are the result of panic buying, with demand up a quarter in the past fortnight. The country's Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has warned the longer the war goes on, the greater the impact will be.
Football and Wales and Northern Ireland have both missed out on a place at this summer's World Cup. Northern Ireland lost 2-0 to Italy in their semi-final playoff. Wales lost to Bosnia 4-2 on penalties when their match finished 1-1 after extra time. The British artist Olivia Dean was the big winner last night at the MOBO Awards in Manchester, which recognises black music and culture.
Olivia Dean!
Her excitement was justified. She took home three prizes, including Best Female Act, Best Song and Album of the Year, which she dedicated to all the black feminists who she said had inspired her to love better.
This album was really just born out of me wanting to write something about love. So thank you so much. I love everyone. See you. Bye.
Other winners included the jazz band Ezra Collective and girl group Flo, and the pop star Ray, whose song Where Is My Husband won Best Video.
Alan, thank you. It's now 8:10. It was surely no coincidence that at the end of what was Wall Street's worst day since the war began, in its fifth consecutive week of stock market falls, the longest such losing streak in nearly 4 years, Donald Trump posted on social media that he was postponing his threat to obliterate Iran. Postponing it for the second time. The president has now given Iran 10 days for talks, which he insists are not just ongoing, but are going very well, despite what he calls erroneous statements to the contrary by the fake news media. Well, this bit of the fake news media can report that his account of what is really going on was backed up this morning by Germany's foreign minister, who says that the US and Iran have had indirect negotiations and that representatives from both sides plan, he says, to meet shortly in Pakistan. Well, to reflect on where we are now and who might emerge as the global winners and losers in this conflict, we're joined by Sir John Sawes, chief of MI6, head of the Secret Intelligence Service between 2009 and 2014. Good morning to you, Sir John.
Good morning, Nick.
Does this sound to you, what we're hearing from the Germans and from Donald Trump himself, like the beginning of the end, or merely, as it were, the end of the beginning?
Well, it's very hard to tell what's going on. You can never believe what the Iranians have to say about these sorts of negotiations. And we've come to learn you can't always believe what the Americans have to say either. So it's pretty clear that the Pakistanis are playing a useful role here, exchanging messages between the two sides. And now how far this is going to go is unclear. There are a lot of pressures, as your introduction has just set out, on Donald Trump to bring this to an end. But he had an opportunity to do that two weeks ago. He could have declared a unilateral military victory and walked away. But now with the Strait of Hormuz closed, it's very difficult for him to claim a credible victory without some movement on the Iranian side. So I think this is going to be very difficult. I'm not sure that these negotiations will prosper. Previous ones between Iran and the United States have stumbled, and the United States has not actually proved a very reliable interlocutor for the Iranians. So we'll wait and see. I'm cautious about this, but it is useful that at least the two sides are talking.
Not a reliable interlocutor is a polite and diplomatic way of saying, why would you talk to someone who might bomb you the next day, isn't it?
Well, you've interpreted it exactly right.
But how then, as a diplomat, if you were involved, do you seek to find agreement? The 15 points of not even a deal, but so-called heads of agreement, are interpreted by most people who know Iran as effectively a demand for outright surrender by them. The 5 points that the Iranians have responded with would be totally unacceptable to Israel and the United States. So how do you go about trying to find some middle ground?
Well, a mediator can help in this, in that an active intermediary will explain each side's demands to the other side and will work out what is most important and what is less important. And I think you need some activity by the mediator, not just a message handler, a message passer. And you need people on the American side, beyond just the hapless Steve Witkoff, who can actually understand the Iranian position and the complexities of some of the demands that the Americans are making, like on the nuclear file, so that you can have a proper, informed, intelligent exchange between the two sides. And this usually takes weeks rather than just 10 days. But we'll see how this goes. President Trump is in a bit of a hurry to get this done, I think, because of the damage it's doing to the US economy.
And meantime, other major powers look on and wonder what it means for them. Let us reflect, if you could, for a few minutes on some of the other players, perhaps starting with China, the United States' long-term biggest strategic competitor. They at the moment seem to have not much of a role, but will they be thinking, this is quite an opportunity for us because it allows us to present ourselves as a kind of stable interlocutor?
I think that's right. I mean, in the short term, China is heavily dependent upon the Gulf for its oil and gas imports. About 20% of their oil and 30% of their liquefied natural gas comes from the Gulf. So it's imposing short-term costs. But the US is weakening itself by this conflict in Iran. As Napoleon famously advised, never interrupt your enemy when it's making a mistake. And I think that's how China is viewing US action at the moment. Is watching very closely what is happening in the Strait of Hormuz. Excuse me, because that has implications for other shipping lanes. Two-thirds of China's trade goes through the Strait of Malacca, with a narrow waterway that joins the Indian Ocean with the South China Sea. There's also the prospect of closing the Taiwan Strait, which obviously is much wider than the Strait of Hormuz, but it's a vital shipping lane, especially for things like semiconductors. So I think Taiwan is watching this. They're watching the limits of air power, the fact that you cannot, you can do a lot of destruction with air power and stand off missiles, but you can't actually change people's minds or change a regime that way. So the Chinese are watching this very carefully, and also for the implications for their own upcoming summit with the United States. Their focus there is on technology, on trade, and on Taiwan. Those are the three priorities they have. I think on the trade and tech side, they will see the weakening of the US economy as a result of the Iran war as an opportunity for them to push their interests harder. And the fact that the United States is going to be so focused on its economic prospects means that the US will pay less attention and deprioritize its security responsibilities in East Asia. And I know that's a concern to the Japanese, the Taiwanese, the Filipinos and others.
And clearly less attention is being paid to the war in Ukraine by the United States, which worries President Zelensky and no doubt cheers President Putin.
There's no doubt that Putin and Russia are one of the big beneficiaries of this war of choice in Iran. I think Russia and Israel are probably the only two countries that, benefit in security terms. And certainly the volume of weaponry that is being consumed in the Middle East means there's less available to go to Ukraine. And obviously the impact on oil prices is a huge boost to Russia's treasury.
And finally, our own continent, Europe, are we in many ways turning out to be the big losers of this?
Well, I think the biggest losers, Nick, are the states of the Persian Gulf, the Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, Oman, and so on. I think they're the ones who have their whole political and economic model is being challenged by this war, and it will take them many years to get back to where they were before if they ever succeed in doing so. So they are the biggest losers here. But I think Europe is a big loser too. We've been struggling to redirect our public finance away from welfare and towards defence and security, which is and towards economic growth, which are the priorities of the government, but they've been unable to persuade Parliament to move in that direction. I think we're seeing something similar in France and Germany, and what has been a rather stagnant European economy looks like being stuck in that mode for quite a few years to come. So yes, Europe is a net loser from all this. The US economy is not quite as badly hit as the European one, partly because it's such a big energy producer itself, partly because it is just more resilient than the European economies. So Europe is a loser, yeah.
Sir John Sawce, Chief of MI6, until 2014. Thanks for joining us.
Interesting. Just as that conversation was taking place, Nick, the Syrian president, Ahmed al-Shara, is going to travel to the UK, we've just been told, next week for his first official visit, unveiling new initiatives offering export finance to UK firms looking to do business with Syria. All indeed is changing in the Middle East. It is 18 minutes past eight now. The government is telling us today that it is on the side of parents when it comes to screen time for children. My government will not leave parents to face this battle alone, says the PM. There is to be guidance for parents, which says, among other things, that mealtime should be screen-free for under fives. Young children should not use AI toys and chatbots. But on the day that the government makes this announcement, the former Conservative Schools Minister, Lord Nash, has told The Telegraph that it's letting down the under-16s by delaying a social media ban, even though he claims there is already ample evidence of harms being done. Let us talk to Josh McAllister, the Minister for Children and Families, who has a long experience of these things and a long interest in them. Good morning to you.
Morning, Justin.
Just set us out, first of all, what the government is saying to parents.
In the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a complete transformation in childhood that's the result of social media, smartphones and screen time use. We are taking big steps with the consultation that's underway at the moment on social media. But we also know that for younger children, there are real demands from parents to know what the evidence says and what some of the guidelines might be for how children who are very young use screens, what they should be looking at, and how parents can help children with their screen use in those first few years. There's been big calls from parents to have better information and guidance on that. So we're publishing that guidance today, and it's linked to our Best Start Family Hubs so that there's some practical tools there for parents as well. Really important to stress, there's no judgment from government on this. It's much easier to say than do some of these things. And as adults, we know all too well that our screen time is something that's difficult to handle.
Yeah, and as adults, I wonder if we might say, hang on a second, there ought to be judgment, because that's actually what people want. They're looking for something that they can latch onto and say, this is what I should and shouldn't be doing. And actually, although the Prime Minister says we're not leaving parents to face this battle alone, I mean, there's tons of government guidance on all sorts of things.
Something to latch onto is actually the right way to think about this. So, you know, 2 decades ago, I think, or so it was, we started to talk in a big way about having five a day, fruit and veg. And I don't know about you, but that isn't a goal that I meet every day of the week. But it is something I've got front of mind when I'm making choices about what I'm eating. And we need some similar social norms around supporting parents for some of the choices over screen use at home. And that's what this guidance does. So it's drawn together all of the available evidence from around the world. It's filtered it through to look at the most robust studies. We're putting that information out there for parents to help them. And I think one of the bits that's probably most important to hold on to is it's not really just the amount of time, it's also what type of content. So the evidence is becoming increasingly clear that algorithmic addictive content with very short, snappy videos, the kind of brain rot stuff you might find on TikTok, is not good for lots of people. It's particularly not good for little children. They need slow emotion.
So to which some parents will say, well, stop it being there.
Well, quite. So this is why the government has got a major consultation underway at the moment. It's why the Prime Minister said yesterday he's personally very concerned about addictive algorithmic content. We are taking powers in the legislation that's going through Parliament at the moment so that when the consultation on social media age restrictions is complete, we will be able to move at pace.
When will that be?
I don't know the exact date, but it's a 3-month consultation. It started about 3 weeks ago, so it's open for another couple of
because
months.
Because what Lord Nash, I mentioned Lord Nash in the introduction, Lord Nash, former schools minister, and of course in the House of Lords, they've just voted again, haven't they, to go ahead with the ban, not that it's going to necessarily lead to anything immediately, and some Labour peers backing it. What he says in the Telegraph today, the government believes we need time to wait and take time to conduct some extremely limited trials. What can these tell us when the overwhelming body of evidence, this is Lord Nash speaking, is that there is a clear link between social media use and harm to our children? Whistleblowers from the social media companies, he points out, have told us that their own internal research, the social media companies have done this research, they found it to be harmful and covered it up, he says. So in those circumstances, why not just go ahead with the ban?
Well, look, I agree with all of that, and actually the government does as well. The issue here is it's not really a question of whether we're going to act on these issues. We will act on them. The Prime Minister, the Tech Secretary have been really clear about that. But there are important details about whether we classify, for example, WhatsApp, YouTube. Are those social media? Are they not social media? There will be all sorts of technology that comes around the corner in the months and years ahead, which might not fit into a traditional definition of social media. So we need to get this right so that it captures the kinds of platforms and functionalities that we're worried about. And we need to make some choices. Do we go down a route of Australia and have a complete ban for those under 16s? Or do we look at data laws? And do we use data law in the UK to create a version of the internet for those under 16 that's different and less driven by data that targets them with advertising? Now, they're all important details, which, frankly, Lord Nash's amendment don't answer. So we agree on the direction, and the government's taking more action than any previous government on this. As you know, I've been campaigning on these issues myself for many years, and so I completely get where Lord Nash and others are coming from, but the government's got a duty to get this right and get the details sorted first.
I just need to ask you about forced adoption too, which is something we're dealing with throughout the programme, actually. We've got another interview coming up after 8:30. When it comes to the idea that the Westminster government should give a similar apology to those who were affected by this set of happenings after the Second World War, and it lasted for some decades, didn't it, that Scotland has given and Wales has given and Australia has given. The suggestion earlier in the programme that we were hearing is that the government is taking its time but is also minded to give that apology. Is that true?
The case for an apology, I think, is very powerful. I said this at the Education Select Committee really recently. The history of what happened here did involve the state, and I think it's really important that we're honest about that. And it was complicated because the state was part of these forced adoptions, but it was also reflecting really appalling attitudes at the time about women, but particularly teenage girls who were pregnant. And I want, you know, anyone who's listening to this program who was affected by this, who's lived with the shame and stigma of it, to know that they should absolutely not, and that what happened was appalling. There was a system of abuse that sat behind this that involved the state, church, social attitudes, and as I say, the case for an apology is really strong. Right. We are actively looking at this at the moment, not just me, but colleagues across government. Bridget Phillipson is really passionate about these issues. So what we want to do is get this right. It's not for me personally to give an apology. I'm a junior minister. This is the sort of issue where the gravity of what happened means that the state itself needs to act.
Well, no, I mean, that's helpful because you made it very clear what you think the government view of this is. And as I say, we'll be hearing from a mother and now grown up child who are very much affected by it in 10 minutes or so's time. Joss McAllister, Minister for Children and Families, thank you very much.
It's coming up to 27 minutes past eight. If you went to bed early with hopes of new qualifications for the World Cup, look away now.
Yeah, afraid not, Nick. For several months, didn't we, there was that tantalising chance of having a third home nation join England and Scotland at this summer's World Cup. But in the end, it just wasn't to be for Northern Ireland or Wales last night. Both sides missed out on a chance to play in a playoff final to reach the tournament. Northern Ireland were beaten 2-0 away in Italy, whilst in Cardiff.
Penalty pain for Wales again, and Wales will not be at the World Cup this summer. And the Wales players are crestfallen. They do not know where to look. The dream has died at the Cardiff City Stadium.
Yes, Wales had led Bosnia and Herzegovina in their semi-final, only to concede a late equaliser. The match ended 1-1, and after extra time went to a penalty shootout, which Craig Bellamy's side agonisingly lost 4-3.
I hurt tonight, and I'm accepting to let that hurt. Now it's sinking in now as I'm talking. It'd be a sleepless night. It'd be difficult to sleep off the back of this one, but it makes me even more determined. Tomorrow, the sun will rise, and I'm going to watch that sunrise tomorrow.
So the Wales manager trying to keep things in perspective. What about the fans in Cardiff?
We're a far better team than them. I believe if we played them 100 times, we'd beat them 99. But I don't know what went wrong, really.
I don't know why you would change something that's not broken. Why would you take Daniel James off when he was having a game of his life?
Gutted, and we back. Proper gutted. Not going to be a good summer now, is it? Going to have to support Scotland.
Could always cheer for England, I guess, or perhaps that's a completely ridiculous suggestion. Let's have a quick chat, shall we, with the former Wales striker, Ewan Roberts, who was at the Cardiff City Stadium last night. Morning, Ewan.
Good morning, Mike.
A tough one to take.
You've made me laugh there. I tell you, you've made me laugh.
Yeah, preposterous suggestion, I know. Slightly tongue-in-cheek. Tough one to take, though, for Wales, isn't it?
It was, and there won't be much sun rising in Cardiff. It's really grey, it's really gloomy. A bit like our spirit. I mean, it's incredible. 2 years ago, two last night, in fact, I was in the Cardiff City Stadium, playoff final against Poland to reach the Euros, and we lost on penalties, and it was deja vu last night. No one would argue with the team that Craig picked. You know, it was the strongest 11 available to him. The problem that he had, players not playing games. Dan Gaines, who is exceptional on the night, he ran out of legs. He's only started four games in the Premier League for Leeds, I think. David Brooks, who also got taken off because he'd run out of gas. He's only started one game for Bournemouth this season. And the subs never really made the impact. Apart from Sauber Thomas, the subs that came on, Liam Cullen and Mark Harris, never really impacted the game.
What about the future, though, Ewan? A bit tight for time, but just want to look ahead. Qualifying for Euro 2028 next. You expect Bellamy to stay and for Wales to make a good fist at that?
Yeah, we've got a good young crop of players coming through. Maybe the strength in depth isn't quite there at the minute, but with experience, these youngsters will get better. You know, we've got a really tough game on Tuesday, a game that no one wanted to play in. It's like a third and fourth place playoff for the World Cup, isn't it, against Northern Ireland, who lost against Italy last night in the Cardiff City Stadium. And then we've got a really strong Nations League A campaign coming up in September, where we play Portugal, Denmark and Norway. And as you say, then qualification. And I'm sure Craig will want another crack at it. You know, that's the type of character he is. He's so proud to be Welsh. He's so proud to be Wales's manager. And I think he'll want another go at it.
Ewan Roberts, many thanks for your reflections on that bitterly disappointing night for Wales last night, I should say, as well. The Republic of Ireland also lost their playoff semi-final, blew a 2-0 lead away to the Czech Republic, ended up also losing on penalties.
Mike, thank you. Let us hear who's on Desert Island Discs with Lauren Laverne now.
My castaway this week is the comedian and writer Sarah Pascal, who looks back on her first stand-up gig in a London pub.
If you do something that really scares you, what you get afterwards is this rush of, I survived it, I'd had two glasses of wine, but what I was high on was, I was scared and I did it, and now that I've done it, now that I know what that feels like, now I want to do it more and I want to do it better.
Sarah Pascal, My Castaway. Join us to hear her Desert Island Discs this morning at 9.
Just to be clear, it wasn't Sarah Pascoe screaming there. Now, let's turn to the weather. Today, cloud and rain will push across southern areas, becoming confined to the southeast later on. Turning brighter behind this, but the northwest will be windy with showers, wintry on the hills.
You are listening to...
The professionals do it better, don't they?
I was going to say you ran out of steam towards the end, but anyway, be mixed. You're listening today on Radio 4, Nick Robinson, Justin Webb. The time, 29 minutes to 9. Alan Smith has the news.
President Trump has said he will delay any bombing of Iran's energy facilities by a further 10 days. He threatened the attacks unless the country reopened the Strait of Hormuz to tankers. Mr. Trump said Iran had requested an extension and he'd agreed because the talks were going well. Iran's denied asking for a postponement. The German foreign minister says he received information that there have been indirect contacts between the US and Iran, and preparations are being made for them to meet directly in Pakistan. The former chief of MI6, John Soares, told this programme he wasn't sure negotiations would prosper because the US hadn't proved to be reliable. Parents in England are being advised not to let under fives watch screens for more than an hour a day. New government guidance also says that children under two shouldn't be allowed to watch screens unless they're accompanied by adults. And the Competition and Markets Authority says it's opened an investigation into five businesses over allegations of fake and misleading reviews online, saying it will try to determine whether they've infringed consumer law. It says the five companies in question are Auto Trader, FIFO, Dignity, Just Eat and Pasta Evangelists.
Thank you for that. 27 minutes to 9 is the time. The government must provide an unqualified formal apology to all those affected by historical forced adoption in the UK. The Cross-Party Education Committee, the Select Committee of the Commons, has been recommending that and recommends it in a report that they launched today. Historical forced adoption practices, they say, involve systematic coercion, removed parental choice, often resulting in lifelong consequences for the mental and physical health of survivors. And you may have heard a junior education minister seeming, I thought at least, to suggest that the government is moving towards that formal apology from Westminster. It would then follow those already given by the governments in Wales, Scotland and indeed in Australia. Let us talk to Anne Keane, former Labour MP herself, former health minister under Gordon Brown, who was sent to a Swansea mother and baby home aged 17 and was forced to give up her baby. And to that baby, to Mark Lloyd Fox, who is Anne's son, who found out he was adopted at the age of 28. Both of them on the line. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Anne Keane, first of all, tell us your story. What happened?
Well, it's not a story. It happened. It's real life. And it happened to me when I was 17. And I had a relationship with a young guy and I didn't know anything about what we should do with sex or anything like that. And this was a 66 and it went too far and I was pregnant. I was terrified, absolutely terrified, because my mum and dad were very proud working class people and I knew they would find this horrific, but also shameful. So to cut a long story short, I was sent away to a mother and baby home in Swansea. And, you know, it was so hard to realise that you were a good person because you were made to feel so bad. Part of the ritual of the day was to do housework and mine was to scrub steps from the beginning to the end and then back to the top again. And it was so, how can I put it, so oppressive for me to feel anything other than, if you love this baby, you will let him go. If you really love this baby, because you're not really fit to be his mother, because you've brought shame on your family and you've brought shame to, you know, for him. And so you think about that and you're browbeaten into believing that you are a bad person. And I was given birth without any pain control. I was had an episiotomy without any local anaesthetic. I was stitched. And when I moved, the doctor slapped my leg. This was all in an NHS hospital. Mm. When I eventually asked, could I see my son? They said no. And I was insistent, and I found what I would call somebody with kind eyes. And she said, yes, you can have him for 10 days, but don't get close.
And Mark, how did you find out eventually that you had been adopted?
I actually found out by good morning. I found out by accident through my godmother, and quite unusually was able to trace my birth mother very, very quickly within about 4 days, and access all of my information, which is not the case for most people who've been through this process. So I was reunited with Anne very quickly. And for me, it seemed to answer more questions than it raised, and brought about some clarity. But in the process of this campaign that has been going on now for so many years for these women and the survivors, the children, I've heard so many stories that have really, really shocked me to the core about how not only systematic this whole thing was, but it was sanctioned by state, church, private sector to a degree, charity sector, organizations, and individuals who funded these homes. And I've seen minutes of meetings from this particular home.
Yeah. And what the government minister, the junior minister, Mark, was telling us of 10 yes. minutes or so ago was that they now accept that, actually. And that's a crucial change between what previous governments have said, which is that, look, this wasn't government policy, so we're not really responsible. They seem to be saying now, yes, we accept it was the state that was at least in part responsible. So the state owes you an apology, and that apology might come. What would it mean first to you, Mark, to have that apology?
Well, I think this most recent select committee for the first time acknowledged it after so many years, and even mentioned the word urgency around the need for doing it. I think it would go a considerable way to alleviating the shame and guilt felt by so many of the women, and the enormous frustration by so many of those children who are just simply asking for their own information to be made available to them. They're not asking for information on anybody else. They're asking for the notes and the file that relates to them in the name that they were originally registered under. And that seems to be either denied them completely or so severely redacted that it doesn't make any sense to them at all, and they glean no information from it whatsoever. And the frustration of that must be absolutely enormous. Well, in fact, I know that it is for them.
And what would it mean to you if the government does act and issue this apology?
Well, it would help me heal, because I still feel the shame. And we've got evidence to say this. Professor Gordon Harold at the University of Cambridge has said and given evidence for some years now on the therapeutic value of an apology would not work unless we had this apology, because we'd still blame ourselves. I still feel, not that it was possible to get myself into trouble, but it would help to heal me, and it would also give me so much hope that nobody should have to go through this. But nobody was a bad person. Nobody was bad. But I was treated very, very badly.
And Keane, we're going to have to leave it there. But thank you very much for talking to us this morning. And obviously, if this apology does come, we'd very much like to talk to you again when it happens. And Keane and Mark Lloyd-Fox as well. Thank you.
It is now 8:40. Despite all the talk about talks, the war does still go on. We do our best each day to try to bring you a picture of what's happening in Iran, despite the obvious and serious limits on our ability to report from the country. Data examined by the BBC shows that Israel has now dropped 3,600 munitions on the city of Tehran in the last 4 weeks and has hit 38 police stations and Basij bases. Many are in the heart of residential areas. The US doesn't provide its data, but it says it's carried out more than 9,000 attacks across Iran. With rare access inside the capital city and using satellite imagery, social media content and interviews, the World Service senior international investigations correspondent Nawal Al-Magafi now reports.
In Resalat, eastern Tehran, a mother in agony. Her daughter has been trapped under the rubble for 3 days. My daughter's scared of the dark, she cries. She calls out for her child. Maryam, she wails. But help has come too late. It's been 3 days since this neighborhood was attacked by Israeli forces. They told us they were targeting a military compound of the Iranian Besiege, part of the Revolutionary Guard. We confirmed the building they targeted was used by the Besiege militia.
The bomb hit so suddenly, it threw me. Then there was another strike.
But that day, three other residential buildings were also struck in quick succession.
I hit the wall and then fell. I tried to stand up three times, but I was knocked into the wall.
This man, who we're calling Ali, has lived in the neighbourhood for 50 years. His building was badly damaged in the attack.
I stood up again, and I don't know what happened. Rubble fell on my head. My hands, my back, my legs, and my ears were bleeding. I don't have anything now.
We gathered as much evidence as we could on the ground and examined satellite imagery from after the strike. Our investigation showed that four buildings were completely obliterated, and the blast damaged homes and businesses in a 65 metres radius. Hours after the attack, the local mayor spoke to the media.
Unfortunately, they destroyed 30 residences. This was no pinpoint attack. They have caused a lot of damage.
Rescuers worked through the night to try and find survivors. Local authorities and residents said at least 40 people were killed, but they said the besieged building had been evacuated. Military experts told us that the scale and spread of the damage in this attack is consistent with the use of one of the largest bombs, the Mark 80, which weighs 2,000 pounds. Ras Alat is one of the 38 police stations and besiege bases we've identified as being hit in Tehran alone, most of them in densely populated areas.
Finally, to the great, proud people of Iran, I say tonight that the hour of your freedom is at hand.
The US and Israel say by targeting police and besiege installations, they're preparing the ground for the Iranian people to overthrow the government.
Stay sheltered. Don't leave your home. It's very dangerous outside. Bombs will be dropping everywhere. When we are finished, take over your government. It will be yours to take. This will be probably your only chance for generations.
But it's the Iranian people that are getting caught in the crossfire.
I don't know who's okay or not. I just know my friends at the end of the alley are all dead.
That was Nawal Al-Mahavi reporting on what is going on at the moment in Iran. It brings us to 16 minutes to 9. And before our next item, I should just tell you that this morning from 9 on Radio 3 Unwind, Dr. Sian Williams brings you 3 hours of soothing, soaring harmonies. Can you soothe and soar at the same time? I suppose you can. From composers such as Edvard Grieg, Franz Schubert and Margaret Bonds.
Now, each day on this programme, we don't try to soothe you, but we do try to equip you with the information you need, the facts, the arguments, the debates that you want to make sense of the world and to have a sense of what might happen next. But here's an awkward question for us to discuss. How good are we at it? We're in a reflective mood this morning, as it is our editor's last day in the job. Last day at the BBC in broadcasting, for now, at least. We presenters, the people you listen to and perhaps occasionally shout at, are the ones who are all too often credited or blamed for what you hear. But it is the producers, and above all, the editor, who deserve the credit and just occasionally a little bit of the blame as well. Awenna Griffiths took over in September 2020, which feels like another era, a time when Boris Johnson was Prime Minister, when the Queen was, well, the Queen, the only one we'd known, and Donald Trump was reaching the end of his time as President, the end of the Trump era, or so we thought. This was the time of COVID restrictions and lockdowns. This was before the invasion of Ukraine, before Hamas's murderous assault on Israel and Israel's devastating attacks on Gaza, before President Trump, the man who promised to avoid wars in the Middle East, began another one. which we are still living with the consequences of. To discuss that, for the last few minutes of the last show edited by Awena, who better to help us than our old friend and colleague Michelle Hussein, now host of Bloomberg's The Michelle Hussein Show, and she will be joined very shortly by Jeremy Bowen, the BBC's international editor, who's off broadcasting on one of many other channels.
Doubtless on the Jeremy Bowen show, wherever that appears.
Michelle, welcome back.
It's lovely to be here to mark Awena's last day.
Yeah. And to think of those COVID days.
Yes, so September 2020, I do have a very, very firm memory of that month because it was the time of both coronavirus restrictions and that sort of attempt in this country to try and get back to normal. And the month that Awena joined, September 2020, was the month that we had the rule of six come in and that whole thing about what it meant to mingle. And I do have a very firm memory of being in this studio and Priti Patel being a guest as Home Secretary down the line and us trying to define the rule of six and have a bit. And I remember Awena being in my ear saying, we still don't know what mingling is. So, you know, obviously, in this time, there have been the big issues discussed. But on a day like this, we can also think a bit about what it's like behind the scenes as well.
When it comes to the big issues, I mean, Nick was saying Donald Trump seemingly on his way out in September 2020. And it looked as if he was going to lose. And indeed, he did lose. But then, of course, came back. So this has been a time. I mean, every five-year period is a time of change, isn't it? But this has been really quite something.
Well, not least because in that intervening period, Donald Trump and those around him went away and really thought about what they wanted to do if they came back, hence Project 2025, and hence everything that turns out was not an unworkable plan, was a plan that they have implemented. And, you know, in the massive international turmoil of these last few weeks, we shouldn't forget that domestically in the US, we had that ruling by the Supreme Court against Donald Trump and the emergency powers that he'd used to implement some of his tariffs. And back in December, when I was interviewing Peter Navarro, the architect of the use of those emergency powers, Donald Trump's trade advisor, I'm afraid I betrayed my origins on this program and in British journalism, because I said to him, if this Supreme Court ruling goes against you, will you resign? And he looked at me as if I was completely mad and laughed, because, of course, that's not a thing.
Well, I think Jeremy's joined us now. You know, the truth is, if we'd had this conversation 5.5 years ago when our editor first became editor, we would have predicted almost none of the things that have dominated our reporting, our journalistic life since, would we, Jeremy?
That's because the world has been turned upside down, not just by Donald Trump, but by other things going on, things like full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
October the 7th.
October the 7th. Loads and loads of things. So the certainty, I think, you know, if you look back, say, back to the Cold War, there was a certain structure. It may have been difficult, may have been dangerous, but in a sense, people knew where they were. And then after the Cold War, in the 90s, there was that period when America was the unipolar power. But now, a lot of those certainties that people used to look at and grasp, I think, at times, have gone. And now we are undoubtedly in a period of change. But what we don't know is exactly what this new dispensation, if there is going to be one, will be.
I wonder if part of our surprise, though, is of our failure to pick up on how much dissatisfaction, indeed misery, that there was as a result, perhaps, of the global financial crisis and the way in which some people were bailed out and some weren't, of a result of COVID, actually, and again, the unequal impact of it. And again, there's a guy called Scott Jennings in the States, a CNN commentator, the only right-wing they've got, who the day that Trump was elected again came on CNN, where they were all pretty shell-shocked, and said, you know what? He was very nice to them, actually. He said, you people just have conversations that most people don't have. You're interested in stuff, various isms he came out with, that actually most people don't talk about. You fail to grasp what has happened to people's lives. And I wonder whether, you know, if we're being a bit self-critical, which I suppose we ought to be as well, and one of the reasons why some people, some reasonable people, say I no longer trust broadcasters as much as I used to, is that we've given up on people.
Well, I mean, certainly the spending on COVID where it did happen, and of course you're right, it was unequal then. That is going to constrain the ability of governments to respond to the economic toll of this present war, because it's impossible to imagine that kind of level of spending again. And yet we can see in multiple ways, some obvious, some much less obvious, of the economic ripple effects of this. I would also add, Jeremy, to the things that have changed. I mean, in September 2020, when Owena took over this programme, the Taliban were not yet back in power, although I think it was pretty obvious the way that that journey was going, even though I think no one predicted how fast the old Afghan government would fall. And the Gulf states, it was impossible to imagine them being anything other than the sort of oases of stability in a troubled region that they appeared then.
Yeah, and they're going to take a long time, I think, to recover that reputation, not just reputation, their entire economic model. Stability, great place to go on holiday, guaranteed sunshine, lovely shopping, the world's leading global airline hub, perfectly positioned for people to fly in and out. All of that stuff now.
And yet, if we'd thought really hard about that, it was predictable that Iran would retaliate in the way it has. And perhaps having US bases in those countries did not give them the security.
And that's why, and when I speak to Gulf people now, Gulf sources, diplomats and so on, they are saying, yeah, of course we'll stay close to the Americans, but we need to think again and we need to diversify. Justin, one quick point on what you were saying about disappointing people. Mm. Liberal democracy hasn't been delivering for people. Mm. That's the key point about this. It's not giving people better lives. And that's why they're saying, wait a minute, do we need this?
It's exactly the point that we had Adrian Wooldridge on the programme the other day, making who's just written a very good book about liberal democracy and making the point that actually it hasn't delivered. There's no use sort of throwing your hands in the air and saying, oh my goodness, all these things are terrible surprises that have come out of nowhere. The system hasn't delivered.
Yeah, you've got to make people's lives better.
And I wonder what underlies that, as it were, both domestically and internationally, is a sense that the rules, the conventions, whether international or domestic, around the way politics is organised or international relations, actually constrained, held in enormous anger. Whether it was anger of people living in Gaza against Israel or Israelis towards the world because they didn't feel defended, whether it was anger in this country or in the United States, it took the removal of some of those rules and conventions to let it out.
Well, the rules, so-called rules-based international order, was always a deeply flawed construct because in so many ways it was Western rules that the West, particularly the Americans, decided when to apply and when not to apply. But, you know, the one thing about having a structure was it did, yeah, it was, I think it probably did act as a constraint, as you say, but it also acted, why am I using past tense here, as a template against which you could measure behavior. You look now at this current war with Iran, and it's very clear what is a legal reason for going to war, an imminent threat or a UN Security Council resolution authorizing it. Neither of those things apply. But did that cause one second of hesitation for the leaders of the US and Israel? No.
I think the other bubble that's worth thinking about is the one that has existed to some extent in this country and certainly in the United States. And that's the bubble of where international news is something different, where there's like what's happening in this country and what's happening overseas. And you sort of regard it. You regard the news, the international news, as a foreign country in itself where you don't really want to go a lot of the time. And I think that also means that the ability of ordinary citizens to think about how the world looks from another perspective, to think that other nations have interests, just as we understand we have interests that drive our government. So I think that's the other bubble that's really worth stepping out of.
But, you know, there's a tremendous lack of empathy in terms of understanding other people's perspectives right now. I mean, look at the way that Donald Trump treats his erstwhile European allies, not least this country.
We've been quite reflective on this the last day of our editor. It's almost it from us. We normally end the programme with some credits to those people who have made the programme. Well, today, on her last day as editor of this programme, after 5.5 years, there's one name that stands out. She's been making, shaping, leading this programme for an awfully long time.
Our editors were Richard Knight and Owena Griffiths. Good morning.
That's all from us. Our editors today were Owena Griffiths and Edward Main.
Owena Griffiths and Emily Wilson were our editors. From John and me, goodbye.
That's all from us for this morning. Our editors were Barney Price and Owena Griffiths. From John and me, good morning.
Some prehistoric presenters, that.
Yeah, I can hear the creaking.
Michelle, it's true, though, isn't it? Whether at Bloomberg, where you now work, or here, it's the people whose voices you don't hear who are often the most powerful voices.
Well, that was another shocking change that came out of the blue, is you leaving. And now we've got a new director general, yeah. Possibly a new head of news. Well, we are getting a new head,
of news.
New head
of news, yeah.
So is she coming back? How might she come back one day?
Well, look, I really want to say something about Awena herself.
Oh, I think she's going to have to address you.
This is her moment. And particularly I want to say something about her style of leadership, because I think we have these assumptions about what authority looks like and sounds like. And frankly, I'm in a room with three men. I think many of them are derived from images of male authority, you know, big, bold statements, grand gestures, plans. And I think Awena's authority...
You're just talking about Jeremy there.
And I think Awena's authority comes from her power of thought. And I think the example that she's given everyone who has been fortunate enough to work with her is that kind of ability to reflect, ability to really think hard and to therefore cut through the noise and see something that others might not. And I think that's unique and precious.
And in recent months, she has given me the chance to do these 10-minute essays, which you've run at 10 past. So you guys go and have a cup of tea when they're going on. Yeah. They run at 10 past eight in the top slot, and which was, I thought... A great deal of trust in me to give me this huge amount of airtime to graze in. But also, I think it's enabled, in terms of what I do and trying to look at the big picture, a chance to transcend some of the constraints of a time-constricted medium and try and develop a few arguments.
But also,
that's a lot of original thinking, Awena.
Yeah, I mean, the point about Awena is that she wants people to say things. I mean, that's why you come on the program, why she wants you on, and other BBC editors as well, and other people she thinks are significant, got things to say. And that, you know, that conversation has got to carry on, hasn't it? Even in an era where a lot of people actually only want to hear things that they already believe. And in your case, Jeremy, you're often telling them things they don't want to believe, but they might be interested in anyway.
Yeah, I think it's important to say things that are true, because if here at the BBC, of all places, if we cannot speak the truth, that we might as well not bother going to work.
Well, when I was reflecting on this morning, I thought we live in an era in which people, when they talk about the media, they mean that flickering, scrolling screen, don't they, which demands that we like or we share or we shout at its content. But despite that, even Michelle can agree with this. It is radio. It is this programme. Yeah. It is the Today programme, which is the country's biggest breakfast programme. And radio at
its
best...
She's not nodding. No, she is now.
...offers... What does radio offer? Intelligence, curiosity, empathy. And those are qualities that our editor, Awena Griffiths, has embodied for these past 5 years.
Yeah. And an extraordinary number of people, I should say, are gathering behind our two guests in the gallery.
Just turn around and look through the window.
Some even waving.